Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, Mr. President. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, baby.
Hello, and welcome to episode 32 of the New Generation Project podcast, where we did it all by ourselves. Woo!
Woo!
Today, we look at the long-awaited showdown between Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels. It's WrestleMania 12. My name is Stuart Brooks, and I'm joined today, as ever, by a certified G and a bona fide stud, Mr. Paul Scrivens.
What does that mean?
And you can't teach that.
You can't.
To his
hang
right.
Hang on, no, explain that first.
To his right is Big Adam Wykes. He's 7 foot tall, and you can't teach
you
that.
You can't teach that.
What's happening?
You need to stop and watch NXT, Paul.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
It's Enzo Amore and Big Cass. It's their entrance. It's very amusing.
But yeah, it's really good.
That does sound like gold.
Yeah, it is gold. I was going to introduce you as the woman, but I didn't.
Thanks.
I can call
I thought
you
should have, because you should have been Enzo Amore. And
right.
He could have been the...
Carmella.
Yeah.
You're hot as hell, and you can't teach that. How are you both
doing? Finally, you got something right.
How are you both doing?
Brill, yeah.
Good.
Yeah, I'm not too bad. I played a gig last night, so I'm quite tired. But
did you drum well?
Didn't drop any massive clangers, so yeah.
Is that a good or a bad thing in drumming? Do you want to drop clangers, or do you not?
I don't actually have any clangers. I was using a metaphor,
clangers, was it the show called The Clangers, or was that part of something else?
There was a show called The Clangers. Yeah.
It looked a bit like... Pink mice that lived on the moon.
With the soup dragon.
Were they the ones with, like, swanny whistles?
Yeah.
How
have you been enjoying the Cricket World Cup, Paul?
I've been enjoying it, but not as an England fan.
Right. Understandably.
Yes, I mean, my favourite player, probably of all time, is AB de Villiers, so he's magnificent.
On absolute fire at the minute.
Yeah, that was beautiful. Nice to see Chris Gayle get a score, although when I watched the highlights of his match, I didn't really feel like he was anywhere near his best.
The thing is, it was against Zimbabwe, wasn't it? So,
yeah.
Not downplaying the score, but it's not like he was doing it against Australia or South Africa. Or...
No, that's true. But still, it was some feat, but it was a lot of power over finesse, which often is with Chris Gayle.
Yeah.
But he's one heck of a talent. It was exciting to watch, but he did give away quite a few chances he could have easily been given out in the first over.
But he was playing such a poor team.
I think that's been a little bit harsh in Zimbabwe. I think they're coming back to a more respectable international side now.
Okay.
Yeah. Adam, what are your thoughts?
I catch up with the cricket on the breakfast news in the morning, so I know that...
England are poor.
England are not very good, and AB de Villiers is good, and Chris Gayle scored lots. There you go.
He catches up on the cricket between ogling Steph McGovern.
Who's from Middlesbrough.
Yeah, well, we were wrong. Yeah. I was wrong. She's not a Geordie. Yeah. She's from Middlesbrough. I retract my previous statement.
but I think you're a little bit harsh towards Steph McGovern.
So I apologise. She's still a lady giant.
I don't think she is that giant.
She is. She definitely is. Watch her next to a normal-sized person.
I saw her do a brief presentation, something economic base, where she was in some kind of washing machine factory talking about testing washing machines.
Stuff like that. She's 7 foot tall and you can't teach that. This is all I'm saying. I gather Mrs. Scrivens went to see 50 Shades of Grey.
That's true. She went with a group of girls to...
Right. You didn't partake in this.
No, I didn't, no.
Is that something that could happen in real life? Your real life, perhaps?
Well, you were there when she came back, weren't you? And you suggested that...
She pushed things up your bottom or something, yes.
No, you didn't.
And she said, well, you never know. I was quite appalled, actually.
Not as much as he will be. Yeah. So there's that for you to look forward to.
No, but you said, what did you say something about? Because you said basically the storyline is rich guy with a helicopter can get...
Women to do whatever he wants.
Yes, that essentially.
And she said yes.
Yeah. Apparently that's the way to go.
Best buy a helicopter then.
Heard they're quite pricey.
In honour of Shawn Michaels achieving his boyhood dream in becoming WWF champion at WrestleMania 12, this week's challenge to you, the audience, was to fill us in on what the boyhood or girlhood dreams of other superstars, or even yourselves, might have been. The following are our favourite suggestions. So this one's from Ricky Michael Hill. CM Punk's boyhood dream was to pull a sickie and have a Ferris Bueller-style day off in order to cheer up his Misery Guts best mate, Colt Cabana. Flagrantly stealing and joyriding Colt's dad's Ferrari around the streets of Chicago, Punk spends the day ordering fine wines and exotic cheeses whilst posing as Abe Froman, Sausage King of Chicago. Luckily, with the help of a coincidental firing on his wedding day, Punk is able to eat all the cheese he likes and even finds time to prank call his headmaster Vince McMahon along the way. Punk even undertakes a wildly ambitious stint as an MMA fighter, and when he wins his UFC bout, he performs a badly lip-synced version of Twist and Shout, while McMahon spends the rest of the day avoiding Punk's angry Doberman, losing his shoes and stepping barefoot in dog shit.
Wow.
That's great, I love that.
I love Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
It's probably my favourite film.
I do, and I love the Twist and Shout bit.
Yeah, that's probably my favourite scene in film history, in fact. It's,
wow.
It's just so feel-good. Mm, like, you can't watch that and not just smile.
And get up and dance.
Yeah, because it's so brilliant. Yeah. If I ever go to Chicago, my plan is to just recreate that entire day. Go to the museum, dine in a fancy restaurant.
Scam a meal.
Yeah, go to a Cubs game. Has Mrs. Scriven seen Ferris Bueller's Day Off?
I don't think she likes it. I think she has seen it and doesn't like it. Because I think I've talked to... Is it Matthew Broderick?
Yes, it is, yeah.
I think I've talked to about this before. I think she may have watched War Games with me, which I'm a massive...
Oh, I like that film. Yeah.
Massive
yeah,
fan of War Games. That's genius.
I'm a fan of, in fact, everything Matthew Broderick's been in except Sarah Jessica Parker. And Inspector Gadget.
And that Godzilla weren't very good either.
I don't mind it. I just look at it as Ferris Bueller Saves New York.
Yeah, if you look at it with those eyes, it's great. But yeah. As a Godzilla film, it's not great.
It's pretty poor.
Matt Lambert says... Bruce Hart's boyhood dream was to be told by Stu and Helen that you are our favourite child and we're proud of you.
That's quite sad, because I imagine that probably was his boyhood dream.
Probably.
Alistair Harding, I had two boyhood dreams. The first was to get a mention on a podcast about mid to late 90s American wrestling, which I achieved on the Slammies episode, probably never to be repeated. The second was to host a military-based quiz show called Skirmish on digital TV channel UK Conquest.
Well, I hope that second dream's gone well for you. Ben Dorber says, Skilo wishes he was a little bit taller.
Did you do that song?
I wish I was a little bit taller. I wish I was a baller.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't know which of you would remember that.
Dan Davis, it was the dream of Ken Raper. To prove all the bullies in school who taunted him for his unfortunate last name wrong by becoming top professional wrestling superstar. Sadly, it didn't come true, and he's now living in a travel tavern, just recording ideas for angles on his dictaphone in hopes he gets a meeting with Vince McMahon. Very nice.
I like that. Big fan. Harry Green. Tony Atlas's boyhood dream was to own his own branch of Clarks. No, I don't get that, but I do have a link to Clark's because my mum used to work in a shoe shop.
Okay.
And actually, when I was quite young, I did do occasional little bit of summer work in shoe shops.
Okay.
So I'm quite familiar with Clark's.
Did she deal with many people with foot fetishes, such as Tony Atlas?
Oh, I doubt it.
That she knew of, anyway. He used to pay women to walk across him in high-heeled shoes, apparently.
How do you know?
Did he do his laugh when they did it?
I hope so. Zach Cooper. Anyone on NXT not to get called up to the main roster?
Ooh. Topical.
Topical. Especially the women.
Pablo Melons. Mine was 1996 Sunny. Well done, Pablo Melons.
I think that got the most likes of any comment on the entire thread. Well done.
Deservedly so.
Yeah.
Matt Blythe, the Yeti, got to live out the boyhood dream of so many people, he got to walk into a ring, dry hump Hulk Hogan into unconsciousness and leave.
Matt Lambert, I don't know what Mean Gene's childhood dream was, but if you call the hotline, I'm sure he'll tell you.
Thane Warne, little Tommy knew one day he would be a doctor. He would go to school and study hard so he could be the very best. He would sacrifice anything in order to one day be the doctor of desire, Tom Pritchard.
I thought you'd like that one, Paul.
Brad Jones, mine was always to make a podcast looking at the new generation era in WWF, but some pricks beat me to it. Sorry about that. My backup dream was to become Bruce... Oh, I can't... the boss.
Springsteen. Thank you very much for your suggestions. There was over 100 this time, which was fantastic. So because we've got a lot to talk about today, we haven't been able to read out so many, but thank you very much for coming up with them.
Very good, though.
There were lots of Jerry Lawler dreaming of children ones, which we couldn't really go into. But thank you for your efforts anyhow. It's Sunday, March the 31st, 1996, and we are live from the Arrowhead Pond in Anaheim, California, in front of a crowd of 15,855, including approximately 3,000 comps, for a live gate of $737,440.
Mm. Is that all? It looked bigger than that,
It looks big.
It looks bigger than a lot of the crowds we've been used to, but that might be because we've been used to kind of 5,000-6,000s.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I've got to say, just the, I don't know if it was really good choice of angles or what, but I thought it looked a big crowd. I was expecting maybe
when you have anywhere where you've got 10, 15 enough people to fill out a packed wide shot, it just looks massive.
Yeah. The show drew somewhere between 290,000 and 300,000 buys, a 1.2 rating on pay-per-view for a company gross of $4 million. So, the pre-show. Todd Pettengill welcomes us to sunny California and the Anaheim Pond. He hypes the major matches and takes us inside the arena. The WWF tag team titles are currently so prestigious that they're being contested on the pre-show.
Yeah, excellent. I found that a bit weird.
When Billy Gunn suffered a neck injury in mid-February, the straps were vacated and an 8-team tournament was set up to determine new champions.
Did they have 8 teams, or did they make some tenuous teams?
Let's see. Okay. The results of the tourney are as follows. In first round matches, on the 24th of February Superstars, Owen Hart and the British Bulldog defeated Barry Horowitz and Hikuchi. On the 2nd of March Superstars, the Godwins beat the New Rockers, Marty Jannetty and Leif Cassidy, a.k.a. Al Snow.
Oh, wow.
Of note here is that the Godwins brought a dog to the ring with them, which proceeded to take a dump in the ring before the match started.
Actually, in the ring?
In the ring.
Ooh, what happened?
They had to get a carrier bag and pick it up, I imagine.
Well, I hope they learned that. Or
they've got
about
a $200 fine.
On the 9th of March, the team of Razor Ramon and Savio Vega beat Tatanka and the 1-2-3 Kid. And on the 16th of March, Superstars, the Body Donners defeated Adam's favourite...
Sonny?
The Bushwhackers.
Oh, okay.
In semi-final matches on the 23rd of March Superstars, the Body Donners beat Savio Vega and Steve Austin, who was subbing for Razor Ramon, something we'll cover later. Mm. And on the 30th of March Superstars, the Godwins defeated the British Bulldog and Owen Hart via disqualification when the New Rockers interfered in the match. Again, as you can tell, this tournament has such a lot of prestige, as everything related to it has been occurring on Superstars and the entire thing has been barely mentioned on Raw. Wow. Sonny interrupts Todd to booze as the Body Donners walk to the ring to decide on new WWF Tag Team Champions. The Body Donners have lovely gold shirts.
Mm.
They're gold reflective crop tops.
Yes.
I just wanted to make that point.
Okay. What did you think of Sonny's outfit tonight, Adam?
Revealingly pleasant.
Vince McMahon and Jerry Lawler take over on commentary as Sonny tells us about her Slammy wins. She's proud of her Best Buns Award.
She is.
She should be.
You would be, wouldn't you?
Yeah. Their opponents are the Godwins. They come out with Hillbilly Jim and some goats.
Yeah, I noted that. I just put goats, question
mark. Why have they got goats?
Because they're farmers. They're
country
boys.
Do they just
boys.
Come out with any animal?
Well, they've had dogs.
Yeah, have they not learned the lesson that animals shit in rings?
Maybe that's why they went to goats. Maybe that's easier to clean up.
Yeah, maybe.
It's just like a test. They're trying to find out which animal has the least loose bowels.
Or were they taunting the kid?
I think you're reading too much into it. I think they've just got goats.
For the only time in WWF history, apparently, something is printed on the canvas.
Ah.
You spot the big WrestleMania 12 logo was actually printed on the canvas.
Yeah, well, I saw something. I
that's
didn't
the
think
only
it was
time it's
time.
Ever happened.
Apparently, but I swear at ECW One Night Stands, there's something printed on the map, but I'd have to rewatch that to check it.
Interesting.
Something a bit different,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah.
Lawler calls Sonny a dreamboat amongst so many shipwrecks, which was a line I quite liked.
Lawler was, again, good on this pay-per-view.
Yeah, he's particularly sharp in this sort of early 96 era.
Yeah, his mockery of Vince McMahon is, frankly, hilarious.
So, quick run-through of this match. We won't spend a lot of time on it. Henry gets a pair of press slams, which gives Vince his first manoeuvre of the night. He also hits his wheelbarrow slam.
That's awesome. I really like that. I do. I think it's a brilliant move.
Phineas's gimmick is that he's an idiot and Henry has to calm him down.
Yeah, well, I think maybe I looked away from the screen for a minute, and when I look back, he's sort of like writhing around.
And mule kicking. And
yeah.
I don't get what the essence of the gimmick is. Is it that he's got like ADD, or is that he's mildly retarded?
Is it
or
a bit like the kind of Festus-y type thing?
Yeah, but it's not clear kind of what it is. We know he can't read from the slammies. Mm. There's a messy spot where it looks like Henry Sandbag Skip on a body slam. I didn't get that they were trying to get over maybe that Skip wasn't strong enough, but it looked like Henry just went, nope.
Well, I didn't know that. I just think the balance wasn't there. That's kind of what I thought.
He's a big bloke, isn't he?
Yeah.
He's 300 pounds. Yeah. Vince calls a leg drop a back drop when the Body Donners execute a double team move. Did you spot that?
No.
He does. Calls it a leg drop. And they get a nice double team version of Tully Blanchard's slingshot suplex.
Yes, that was very good.
Yeah. Phineas looks for the slop drop, but Sunny flashes him her Slammy Award winning best buns. He gets distracted. Fair play. Mm. And Skip rolls him up with a schoolboy for the win and the tag team titles. Thoughts on this one?
Quite short.
Yeah, it was, there was nothing great to it, really, was there? Just because there was nothing great to it. It wasn't a bad match.
There's that wheelbarrow thing. That also, it was worth seeing this match just for that.
The slingshot suplex was nice as well.
Yeah. Godwin's press slams were quite cool. Sonny's butt was quite good. I don't know.
I just thought it was about as basic as you could get, really, because it was probably, about 3 minutes at best.
It was a shame, because actually, I reckon given something like about 7 or 8 minutes, these two could put on quite a nice little match.
Yeah. I mean, the fact that the tag team titles are currently being decided on the pre-show at WrestleMania kind of tells you everything you need to know about the level they're at.
Yeah.
And Sunny's impact upon the decision tells you she's kind of the priority for that division. And at least for the next sort of 4 or 5 months, this division is built more around her than any team in particular.
Which is really weird.
Which is odd. Sadly, she's not really on the rest of the show.
Nah, never mind.
Never before in the history of the World Wrestling Federation has one single force generated the intensity and raw energy of the Ultimate Warrior. No one could instantly electrify a crowd like the Warrior. Empowered by the Warrior inside the heart of all of his fans, the Warrior's rise to the top of the World Wrestling Federation was unquestionably meteoric. WrestleMania 6 became his launching pad, blasting off in front of 67,000 fans, defeating the self-professed immortal Hulk Hogan. The very next year, the Ultimate Warrior continued to soar through WrestleMania 7 with a victory over the Macho Man Randy Savage. And then, mystique turned to mystery. The Ultimate Warrior vanished. Yet in his absence, the legend of the Ultimate Warrior continued to grow. But now, after a great deal of anticipation, the Ultimate Warrior returns to the World Wrestling Federation and WrestleMania. Brace yourself for the return of the most intense, reckless, skyrocket of them all, the Ultimate Warrior.
He was faster than a cheetah, stronger than a grizzly, more terrifying than a great white shark. And just when they thought it was safe to go back into the ring,
we get a hype video for the Warrior with foreboding music. Oddly, it cuts into another hype video for the Warrior.
Yeah, that was interesting. That was just like two slightly different promos.
He gets two videos because he's so good.
Did you notice they referred to Hulk Hogan in that as the self-professed immortal?
Yeah.
Are you excited yet for the Warrior?
Yes.
Look at him. He can barely contain it.
No, at this point when you're watching it, because I've never seen this pay-per-view, and obviously I loved the Warrior before.
Yeah.
I was aware that he came back at this time, but I've never really seen any of it. But yeah, I have a degree of excitement for it.
And Paul, as someone who's not particularly familiar with him, are you excited?
I'm intrigued, but I'm not excited.
I'm quite intrigued,
because obviously there's a lot said about the Warrior, but although I've seen tiny little bits of him before, it is clips rather than matches, so I don't really have any detailed knowledge.
There's not that many great whole matches that he did.
You've seen the documentary, the self-destruction one?
No, I haven't.
Oh, you haven't?
No.
Oh, okay. I thought we would have shown you that at some point.
No, you haven't.
It's not very complimentary towards him.
They're more complimentary these days.
Yes.
We get an odd cut back to Todd, who throws to a hype video for Diesel and The Undertaker. Now, that's a match I'm actually excited to see.
Mm.
Up next is the geriatric match. Which comes complete with Mystery Science Theatre 3000-style commentary from Vince and Lawler. Is that something you're familiar with?
No, but there were just silhouettes in front of the screen. Is that what you mean?
Yeah. I'm aware of it, yeah.
I didn't expect Paul would be. I'm surprised you're not kind of familiar with it.
I've never watched any of it, but I know about it and I know it exists.
They need to release a box set over here because I think you'd find it very amusing.
Yeah, I think I would.
The match appears to be held in some sort of garage somewhere, presumably another dig at WCW.
Yeah, with rubbishy little lights and low production values and like little camcorders and that kind of thing.
Yeah. Do we cover this? Is this the end of this?
This is the end of this. Thank God for that. The Nacho Man is announced as being from Rogaine, Florida.
Is that the hair stuff?
That's the hair regrowth stuff, yeah. Old geezers in the crowd read newspapers, and someone holds up signs telling the audience when to cheer and when to boo. The Hookster enters, and he's from Geriatric Beach, California.
Yeah. He's got a Zimmer frame, hasn't he?
Did you notice it's a different guy playing the Hookster?
No.
Is it?
Yeah, it's a different person from the skits.
Oh.
Yeah.
There's bits of this that I thought were mildly amusing. I thought the fact that it took multiple people to rip the Hookster shirt was...
I thought he comes to the ring with his walker and they fast forward his entrance, which I thought was pretty funny. He stops midway on the ring to get oxygen as well. Billionaire Ted is the referee and he and Scheme Gene help the Hookster rip his shirt. Lawler says, what the pharmacist gave him, Father Time has taken away. Nacho tries to climb the ropes but can't manage it. Falls over. He gets brought back to life by a medic. And what are those things called?
Defibrillators.
Yeah. That's it.
I don't know. They zap him back to life and he just goes, oh yeah.
Hookster rolls away and Nacho grabs a lady's shoe, but the Hookster has a chair and they clock each other and they're both down. Ted declares the match a draw. That's it.
They're both expired.
Well, actually, you missed a really good bit that before the match that Ted Turner, or what's his name?
Billionaire Ted.
Billionaire Ted said, may the best and highest paid wrestler win.
And then he winks at the Hookster. Yeah. Scheme Gene interviews Ted and asks him what's going to happen with his wrestling organisation now his top stars have expired. Ted says they can die all they like. He'll just buy more stars.
He does.
In fact, one of them's on this show. Someone dressed all in black wearing a T-shirt that says FTC surprises Ted, and he dies too. We cut back to the arena, and the crowd boos. I actually thought this was pretty funny for what it was.
I thought there were certain bits of it that were mildly amusing, yes.
Yeah, if it wasn't like super offensive towards the Macho Man, maybe.
The thing is, this could have been 10, 15 minutes. If it was a Raw segment now, they'd invest half an hour in it and it would die on its arse.
Yeah, but I guess it was just a couple of minutes.
Given how nasty some of the later Billionaire Ted skits have turned, this was actually refreshingly comedy rather than... It's mean, but it's not as mean as those later Billionaire Ted skits were.
I kind of think that's almost the thing. If you're going to do something mean, it's got to be... It's got to be really funny to justify it.
And this was relatively funny. We get a hype video for Shawn Michaels and his pal Jose Lothario. And I'm pretty sure all of this is designed to make Shawn look like Rocky.
Yes. Well, I put HBK as Rocky and then I put, Jose!
Does it hurt Shawn Michaels' lady killer character that he's got this old Mexican bloke hanging around with him?
Well, I think it's telling a different story at this point. I don't think it's going to affect it because the rest of it is so established.
Right. We cut to a hype video for the Iron Man match, but more specifically Shawn, and then right into a training package for Brett. Brett references knowing 3 or 4 years ago that Shawn would be the one knocking on his door for a spot, as he had with Randy Savage.
Yeah, it's quite interesting that he talked about having passed Randy Savage.
Yeah, plus it's interesting that he says Randy Savage rather than Hulk Hogan.
Hogan, yeah.
You know, Hogan was the top star, but does that say anything to you about that Savage is still in the good books, whereas Hogan might not be?
Maybe Hart wouldn't want to compare himself to Hogan because he is much more the in-ring performer.
Yeah, I think so.
You know, and the wrestler, which I guess we see Macho Man being as a better wrestler than Hogan was.
And I put for this bit because it was still kind of like lots of training stuff. Stu Hart! Stu Hart!
Well done.
Yeah.
Before we go to the main show, we get Doc Hendricks speaking retrospectively about the weekend, which was a bit odd. Apparently, they all had a lovely time. So we see some highlights of a charity softball game and the Slammies.
Yeah.
It is the dream of the challenger to become champion, the crowning achievement in a lifetime of yearning. It is the dream of the champion to aspire to excellence, his legacy indelibly etched in the annals of time. Shawn Michaels, the confident challenger, a maverick who spits in the face of adversity. Bret Hart, a triumph in tenacity, the mighty ring general who stands in defiance of defeat. Tonight, for one illustrious hour in the Iron Man match, we will witness their passion, applaud their heroics, marvel at their gift to enthrall. Two craftsmen engaged in an extraordinary athletic event, two men bound by the dream. After 60 grueling minutes, one man, exhausted, will have his arm raised high, the quest realized, the challenge overcome. One man, expended, will breathe loneliness. Unwilling to surrender, he will have been stripped of the dream.
On to the main show, we get some more hype for the Iron Man match, and I'll give them that they're really going all out on trying to make this match feel like a really big deal.
And the videos are very good. I'd say there's probably a bit too much of it for my liking. But yeah, again, decent level of video production.
We get a little helicopter graphic and the Mania logo made up to look like the 20th Century Fox one. Vince McMahon welcomes us to WrestleMania and introduces Jerry Lawler. This is a Vince McMahonism, which I don't know as if we've discussed very much, but I'll bring it up here. Vince really doesn't know the meaning of the word notwithstanding. He just brings it up randomly in sentences, like, welcome to WrestleMania, notwithstanding the main event. What does that mean, Vince? That makes no sense. Our opening bout for WrestleMania is Vader, Owen Hart and the British Bulldog versus Yokozuna, Ahmed Johnson and Jake the Snake Roberts. On the February 26th Raw, Yokozuna faced off against the British Bulldog and Owen Hart in a handicap match. Yoko fared pretty well until Vader wandered out and interfered, causing the DQ. Camp Cornette then put the boots to the former WWF champion until Ahmed Johnson and Jake the Snake Roberts wandered out.
Why then?
I have no idea, other than they both needed something to do at WrestleMania, really.
Oh, right.
In fairness, they had both won matches earlier on that same episode of Raw, so there was somewhat of a logical explanation as to why both of them were there and they were both in their wrestling gear.
Yeah.
On the 11th of March Raw, the British Bulldog and Owen Hart took on the team of Yokozuna and The Undertaker, who must have put all that casket burying nonsense behind them, made up. When Taker was forced to leave the match, which we'll cover later, the bout turned into another handicap match. When Yokozuna managed to get the advantage, again Vader wandered out and attacked Yoko, with Ahmed Johnson and Jake Roberts again coming out to make the save. If this sounds like the same angle as I just described before, it pretty much was, except this time the segment ended with the heels with the advantage. The 18th of March Raw opened with a match between Jake the Snake Roberts and the British Bulldog. During the bout, Vince McMahon referred to the fact that Jake Roberts had made a challenge for a six-man tag team match to be held at WrestleMania 12 during that weekend's episode of Superstars. Bulldog would win the Raw match via countout when Roberts chose to chase Jim Cornette with his snake. Later on in the show, Vince McMahon interviewed Camp Cornette. Cornette accepted the bout for his men before letting Owen Hart do some talking, which was a good idea, then letting the Bulldog talk, which was a less good idea. Cornette called Yokozuna a blithering idiot and Mr. Fuji senile.
Yeah, fair enough.
Vader finished their portion of the segment with some shouting, which is always a good idea.
Yeah.
The video wall then showed short promos from Yokozuna and Jake Roberts, but sadly not Ahmed Johnson. Yokozuna then claimed that in the fine print of the contract, that should the face trio win, Yokozuna would get 5 minutes in the ring with Jim Cornette. Surely this identifies Clarence Mason as a shit lawyer.
The fine print on his contract.
Yeah, he didn't check the fine print on his contract. But Jim Cornette has a lawyer character as part of his act, and he signed this contract that this guy didn't read. On the 25th of March Raw, Owen Hart took on Ahmed Johnson. During the match, Davey Boy Smith came out to ringside and interfered, causing the DQ, with Ahmed about to hit the Pearl River Plunge on Owen. Pretty much the same thing as all the other angles then happened, with Vader coming out first to join the assault, and then Yokozuna and Jake Roberts coming out to make the save. Vader enters first with Jim Cornette, followed by Owen Hart and the British Bulldog to Owen's theme.
I do love Owen's theme. The more I hear it, the more I like it.
It is good.
I like Vader's theme as well. I think Vader's theme is cool.
We see highlights of Yoko's turn on Cornette from Raw in February, and Yokozuna enters next to somewhat of a face pop.
Yeah.
Followed by Jake Roberts and Ahmed Johnson. Vader and Yoko square off first with fists, and we get a six-man brawl to open. The faces get Vader alone in the ring, and rather than triple-team him, Yokozuna clotheslines him to the outside. Yoko then Irish whips Ahmed to the ropes as Ahmed executes one of his scary, scary dives.
Yes.
I love Ahmed Johnson.
I kind of was writing something at that point, so I kind of just looked up, and Ahmed Johnson was just like, flying through the air, falling through the air towards his destiny.
I'd love to know what's going through Ahmed Johnson's head when he do this. I'd like to think it's just like, I'll give it a go as he's running up to the ropes. And just like tumbles over the top.
I'll probably be fine. Yeah, there's something just not graceful about his dives. Fair play for trying them.
He's a big, muscly powerhouse, and he's just like trying stuff that Ray should be doing.
Yeah, chucking himself over the top rope. Sort of head first.
I mean, I like that there was a bit just after this in the match where when Owen's tagged in and he's vulnerable in the corner. And yeah. Bulldog whips him out of the way. It's a little bit like, oh, it was the
Heavenly Bodies
against, who were they against?
Rock and Roll Express.
Rock and Roll Express, oh yeah. Yeah, back from one of the early pay-per-views.
Survivor Series 93.
Oh, well remembered.
Back inside, Yoko and Vader lock up, but go back to exchanging punches. Vader tags Owen and drop kicks Yoko from behind to no effect. Fair enough.
Yeah.
Yoko looks to charge Owen in the corner, but Bulldog pulls him out of the way and the heels gain the advantage.
That's what I was talking about.
Vader tags back in and punches Ahmed Johnson on the apron for no reason. Vince refers to Owen as that pesky individual.
I've got that written down as well.
That was a bit Scooby-Doo.
Yeah, it was just a bit odd.
He would have gotten away for it if it wasn't for that pesky Owen Hart.
Yeah. Jinx. Why is Yoko working like all of this match so far? Like, surely that's a bad idea.
He's gassed.
Yeah, he probably needs to have a rest now.
Vader gives him more punches to the corner and poses for some heat. Vader swings and misses a punch, so Yoko hits a rock bottom and tags Ahmed.
That was awesome. And what I'd say is the punches in this match, particularly the Yoko Vader, it does just look as if they're beating the crap out of each other.
Vader is snug, shall we say.
Yeah, well, I don't think it's snug. I think it's kind of just fierce.
But I will say it's not the most blatant punch we see tonight.
Oh, yeah, that's true, yeah.
Ahmed runs wild on Owen and the Bulldog and hits a power slam on Davey Boy. Vader cheap shots Ahmed from behind and takes him down. And Ahmed looks for a sunset flip, but Vader blocks, looks to squish Ahmed, but Ahmed moves. He then hits a diving shoulder onto Vader while screaming. There's a lot of shouting when he's flying through the air.
It's fair enough.
Vince then refers to the heel trio as, and I quote, a pack of wolves or a pack of buffalo or a herd of buffalo.
Or a herd of buffalo. Yeah, I've got that as well. Yeah, Vince's commentary was bonkers. It's like he doesn't really know what he's saying.
What the collective terms for different groups of animals are. Ahmed looks for the Pearl River plunge on Davey, but Cornette gets on the apron to distract the referee, and Owen appears from nowhere to dropkick Ahmed.
That was amazing, because you didn't catch that at the time when we watched it together, did you? It's just brilliant, because it is literally from out of shot.
Yeah.
And we rewound it, you can just see it. When there's a shot of Cornette distracting the ref, you can just see Owen going up top in the corner, but your next thing is, you focus on the middle of the screen, and literally Owen flies in. Awesome.
Owen attempts to enziguri Ahmed, but it doesn't look great, and I think that's mostly Ahmed just being in the wrong sort of position for it.
To be fair, he kicks him in the middle of the back. He doesn't get high enough.
Owen tags Vader and he splashes Ahmed. Vader then hits a Ho Train attack and tags back to Owen, who rakes Ahmed's eyes, but his clothesline has no effect. Ahmed gets one of his own to take Owen down. Jake Roberts' gear quickly. He's upgraded from his In Your House 6 Primark t-shirt.
Yeah, we talked about this.
I think he's lost a little bit of weight.
Yeah, yeah.
Like the belly's smaller. But and now he's got some sort of waistcoat with clasps.
Yes, that's the thing that I noted, that I thought actually it looked like quite a good outfit, but it's just got these, clasps, like little fastenings on the front, which kind of spoil it a little bit.
But it did look better than the grubby Primark t-shirt.
Well, yes, I think it looked quite good. You know, this and the trousers, that I thought it was quite a good look.
Out of nowhere, Mr. Fuji has appeared and is waving an American flag.
Yeah, we saw that.
What a traitorous person.
Like, but why didn't he come out with Yokozuna at the start? Or did he start walking down the aisle and he's just made
so
it?
He's so old that...
He had to borrow the Huckster's frame.
So, but I get that he's turned face, but does that mean he's American now?
I hate that sort of thing. Yeah. If you're a good guy, you've got to be waving the American flag. Even if you're painfully Japanese.
Would you describe him as being painfully Japanese?
The most Japanese person, you know.
Okay.
I'm not sure it's painful, though. That one.
Yeah.
I think you've got that all wrong.
Maybe it's the wrong adjective to use.
Ahmed gets the tag to Jake, who takes Owen and Davey down with punches.
Well, he gets a good pop.
Yes.
I think probably the biggest pop of this match.
A short arm clothesline, and he signals for the DDT, but Owen holds onto the ropes. Jake charges Owen in the corner, but Owen gets his knees up and tags the Bulldog. He hammers on Jake for a bit before tagging Vader, who hammers on Roberts. This is a bit of an odd match in that it's essentially been three extended heels work heat on the babyface segments.
Yeah.
Like, there's been very little kind of shine from the babyfaces apart from Ahmed gracefully flying to the outside. And the
this sort of stuff that allows Yokozuna to have that rest that I was talking
he
about.
He does still look knackered about
He's
10 just, minutes.
He's
yeah,
yeah. leaning over the top rope with his arms over, just
sweating
away.
Vader tags Owen, who hits a nice elbow from the top rope for the first two count of the match. Bulldog tags in and hits his running power slam, but Jake kicks out at two for a pop.
I do like that running power slam. That is good.
Vader returns to the ring and hits a splash for a two, and Bulldog attempts a really sort of odd-looking leg drop, but Jake moves, looking for about the eighth hot tag of this match. Bulldog tags Vader, and Jake gets the hot tag to Yoko, who hammers on Vader in the corner for the biggest pop of the match so far.
Yeah.
He takes down Owen and Davey as well with a double noggin knocker. Ahmed enters and hits the Bulldog for no reason. Yoko hits a Samoan drop and tags Jake as the crowd chants for the DDT. He looks for it on Owen, but Bulldog breaks it up. Ahmed takes Davey Boy to the outside and Jake hits the DDT on Owen. Jim Cornette enters the ring and looks to hit Jake with his tennis racket, but Jake cuts him off.
This is the biggest pop of the match, actually. It's when he's teasing the DVD on Cornette.
DVD?
Yeah, he teases the DVD. He says, I'll make you watch King of the Ring 95.
And everyone in 90... Oh, no, did DVDs around?
Not in 1995.
They started to come out in about 97. Yeah, he's predating the DVD.
DDT, sorry. Put that in.
Jake looks... What, you just want me to splice that back in?
Yes, please.
Jake looks for the DDT on Cornette, but turns around and is faced with Vader. Vader takes him down and hits a Vader bomb for the three count at 13:08. It was somewhat of a formulaic match, but I did not enjoy it.
Yeah, I didn't mind it. There's enough going on to keep it interesting.
I didn't dislike it, but I didn't like it.
Yeah, yeah. I guess the right team won, as the heels definitely carried like 90% of it. And what you've got here is you've got a heel trio that are all really talented and a babyface trio that are all really over, despite maybe being somewhat limited. Yoko by his size, Jake by his age, and Ahmed by his lack of competence.
And you get over through lack of competence?
Yeah, he got over it. he's over.
He is, yeah.
But he's lacking in competence.
I understand how people would cheer Ahmed, but I don't know why. I feel that I quite like him, but I don't really know why.
You like him because he does crazy dives to the outside and you can't understand what he's saying.
His awesome promos.
There's not a lot of segments or backstage interviews in this show.
No,
it's very straightforward.
I always think that if you do them too many of them, that they're really to the detriment of a show. But I miss it when there's not really many of them there.
Right.
So far, what have we had?
We've just had the pre-show stuff, really. We lead straight into our next match anyway, which is Roddy Piper versus Goldust in a Hollywood backlot brawl. On the 19th of February Raw, Goldust defended his Intercontinental title against his longtime foe Razor Ramon. With Razor having wrapped up his feud with the 1-2-3 Kid at In Your House 6, it seemed logical that he'd resume his programme with the man who beat him for the IC strap. With Razor getting the upper hand, Goldust and his valet Marlena bailed from the ring, giving the bad guy a count-out victory. Post-match, Razor grabbed a mic and proclaimed, "Goldust, I don't want your belt, I want your ass." Okay, then. He's pretty sure that's what Goldust wants. He went on to say, "R.E. Goldust, I don't want my kids watching this kind of stuff on TV." He demanded that interim president Rowdy Roddy Piper give him a match with Goldust anywhere, anytime. And that would be the end of that.
Okay.
As on the 21st of February, Razor Ramon, a.k.a. Scott Hall, sent a telegram to Vince McMahon giving his 90-day notice to the WWF. In completely unrelated news, that very same day, Scott Hall was suspended by the WWF for marijuana use and or something related to family problems. Hall had apparently become somewhat of a problem backstage by this point, but his behaviour and issues were not new. It's obvious that the suspension was simply made out of spite.
Yeah.
The suspension would run through WrestleMania, nixing the Goldust Razor feud and losing Hall a pretty large payday. Mm. The WWF had actually taped a segment between Piper and Razor where Piper booked a Miami street fight for WrestleMania, but obviously it never aired. Believing Goldust still worthy of a WrestleMania bout, the WWF needed a replacement opponent. Fortunately, they had one ready.
Yeah.
On the following week's Raw, a phone call from Goldust was inserted into Vince and Lawler's commentary over an Ahmed Johnson Shinobi match.
Shinobi?
Shinobi would be Al Snow under a mask.
Okay. Yeah.
Goldust read a poem, and I'll read it for you now. You ready?
Not sure I am, but...
Should we not get Paul to do this in a sexy voice?
No.
Maybe it's the intro for the next episode. "They call you the Hot Rod, but what exactly do they mean? A towering inferno of a temper, but beneath that skirt you are anything but lean. You preside over the World Wrestling Federation in a fashion that is so far gone. With those sexy temper tantrums, you turn me on. Mr. President Piper, you are so mean, so hard, so ripe. To you I have but one request. When does Goldust get to play that bagpipe?"
Ripe? That's creepy.
He wants to play his bagpipes. That's creepier. Paul is pulling somewhat of an odd face.
What can we read into that?
Yeah, what have you taken from that, Paul?
So that I should stop doing this show.
Later on in the show, Jim Ross urged the audience to call the WWF hotline to find out whether Roddy Piper... No. Hang on. To find out whether Roddy Piper and Goldust are really an item.
With the WWF gay sex line.
On the 4th of March Raw, Goldust hosted an edition of Piper's Pit, directed by Marlena, which was apparently edited for television with several sort of weird jump cuts. He reeled off any number of sexual innuendos, eruptions, rising, etc., before alleging that Piper had invaded his set, i.e. Hollywood. Goldust ended the segment by erotically playing the bagpipes. Yeah, it's something you want to say, Adam?
No. No, there's not.
Piper then called into the show during a Hakushi versus Justin Hawk Bradshaw match, claiming that he already faced Adrian Adonis, so he knew what Goldust was up to, re mind games. On the 11th of March Raw, Goldust and Roddy Piper faced off in the ring, with Piper making various gay slurs at Goldust, but did refer to Goldust as a great athlete before referring to himself as a lesbian.
What?
Okay.
That's not some bizarre.
Goldust responded, rubbing himself and kneeling down in front of Piper, inviting Hot Rod to his backlot. Goldust then tried to look up Piper's kilt before the segment degenerated into a game of slaps. Piper then accepted the backlot brawl and claimed that he would make a man out of Goldust at WrestleMania. On the 18th of March Raw, Goldust faced off against Make a Difference Fatu. After disrobing, it was revealed that Goldust was wearing a kilt. Again, Piper called in during the match and he wasn't happy. More disturbingly, as this call was going on, Goldust began to teabag Fatu. Seriously, watch it. That's definitely what he's doing.
All this stuff is deeply strange, isn't it? And mildly offensive.
On the March 25th Raw, Goldust quoted Pinocchio and played with a mannequin dressed up as Roddy Piper. More gay innuendo, and he threw the mannequin against a wall. This skit seemed to be filming in the same area as the initial part of this upcoming backlot brawl, and this part of the match was actually taped a few days prior to WrestleMania.
Wow.
Anything you want to offer, Paul?
I don't know. What are they thinking?
I think that we commented last time we saw Goldust as, oh my God, I can't believe they're doing this. Yeah. And I seem to think you said it'll get worse or something along those
lines. Yeah,
I
think that's what we said.
And I didn't really believe you.
No.
But yes, it has. All this stuff just sounds really unthinkable, wrong. Actually. In current times, it thinks it's unthinkable.
And what sort of time was this being aired?
You know, same time on Raw. It's, you know, it's like 8, 9 o'clock on a Monday night.
It's like, here's your heel character. He's gay.
Yeah, like I say, there are various gay rights groups that are very upset about Goldust being portrayed as, like, a predatory homosexual.
Rowdy Roddy Piper. His name in the World Wrestling Federation is synonymous with only one word. Legend. During his glory days, the proud man from Scotland taught many an opponent the hard ways of the ring. And if they didn't listen, off to the pit they went. As acting president of the World Wrestling Federation, things have been no different. Now ruling from his oval pit, Rowdy Piper once again has the final word. But who knew that such power would turn a bizarre individual on? From the hills of Hollywood, the unique Goldust seemed to have been taken with the authoritative president. As a matter of fact, he not only dedicated a poem to him, but he expressed his innermost feelings toward him in a special pit of his own. Now a man in office, Piper knew it was in his best interest to turn the other cheek. But when he did, it was slapped in an act of violent rage. Pushed to his limit, Piper responded in typical Roddy fashion.
You want to fight, you jerk? Then I'll fight you, God! And you know what? I'm going to make a man out of you!
We get a video package for Roddy Piper and Goldust, and Marlena is in the locker room watching WrestleMania. That's nice for her. We cut to the back lot where Roddy Piper waits for Goldust with a baseball bat. Goldust rocks up in a gold Cadillac and teases running Piper over. Piper hoses down the car and smashes the windows of it in with his baseball bat.
See, to start off with, I thought this was going to be some just car washing segment like that, the Divas thing that you like so much.
This is nothing like that Divas
thing.
No,
it turned out not to be.
I thought when it started off that it's going to be some sort of hate crime. There's an angry man with a baseball bat that's going to trans
a homosexual
for being gay.
Yeah. Piper chokes Goldust with the bat and really clocks him with it.
Yeah.
He shoves Goldust's head through a random catering table and whacks him with a metal bin.
Yes.
Why is there a buffet there in the rain?
Yes.
I don't know. I have no answer.
It is literally, it's like you're going to some kind of event and there's just like a trestle table.
With some food on it.
With some sandwiches, some sausage rolls, maybe some samosas.
Out in the rain.
Out in the rain.
there are people there, so it's kind of, all right, there's going to be a fight down a back alley. Let's all turn up. Who's going to bring the buffet?
Yeah.
I'll do it. All right.
Do you think most gang fighters actually have catering?
Catered.
So he says, it looks like rain. He says, don't worry, it'll be fine. I'll bring the buffet.
Yeah. Piper gives Goldust a bit of a beating before hosing him down. Piper hits a weak body slam onto the car as they fight on the bonnet. Blood has appeared from somewhere, and I think it's from Piper's hand.
Yes, it is from Piper's hand.
He full-on punches Goldust in the face.
Yeah,
like full-on,
yeah,
right in the face. Like, he grabs his face, sets up, and just punches him in it.
Yeah.
Stiff.
Mm. Very, very.
Lawler asks if Piper has been watching Natural Born Killers too much. Goldust fights back with a low blow and gets in his Cadillac to run Piper over. No.
As hardcore weapons go, the car's a pretty good one.
It's better than one of those, like, well, metal bins that just break in half.
Yeah, bacon trays.
Yeah. Piper manages to get on the hood of the car to avoid the second murder we'd have seen on live pay-per-view. Goldust escapes in the car as Piper runs to a nearby car, a white Ford Bronco. He drives off, presumably after Goldust.
Weird.
Thoughts on the segment of this match?
Is this a bit where... Hang on, let me check. Is this a bit where he crashes the car? There's certainly a bit where he drives it badly and crashes it a bit.
Goldust, when he first comes in, crashes into that Bronco car.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a bit, yeah. I've also put two more notes on this bit here. Firstly, it was Rikishi. And secondly, it's now going to be a monster truck match at Backlash.
Excellent. Any semblance of meaning to the white Ford Bronco to either of you?
No.
Oh, is it O.J. Simpson?
Well, fucking hell, really?
Is that why they were doing the car chase with the helicopter shot?
Our next match...
Have they just put, like, helicopter footage from that chase and spliced it into a pay-per-view?
Hang on.
It kind of made me think of... Well, was this, like, the precursor to the hardcore matches?
It's very much reminiscent of, like, the 99 hardcore stuff, yeah. Or not reminiscent, whatever the future version of reminiscent is. Precursor to.
Yeah.
Well, was it Hardcore Holly versus, like, Al Snow? Some of that stuff where it's all outside in the back. And,
yeah, it definitely looked a lot like that. So our next bout is Stone Cold Steve Austin versus Savio Vega.
Isn't it Gillian McCreese?
Our only major look at Steve Austin so far on the show has been his match with Ricky Steamboat way back at Bash at the Beach 1994.
And his passionate speech at the Slammies.
Obviously.
But also that Royal Rumble, which did we later find out some information about the Royal Rumble? Wasn't he supposed to be in for longer?
But he fell out over the top, yeah.
Because he had, was it greasy hands?
Greasy hands, like you.
Or something, yeah.
What had he been doing?
Probably...
And he touched Ahmed Johnson accidentally.
Austin's route here has been pretty well documented, so we'll just cover it briefly.
Yeah.
Following his feud with Steamboat and the influx of Hogan and his pals into WCW, Steve Austin became somewhat less of a priority to WCW's creative team than he had been. When injury forced the Dragon to retire from in-ring competition, the scheduled rematch with he and Austin at Fall Brawl 94 on September the 18th was abandoned. Austin was instead ordered by WCW Commissioner Nick Bonkwinkle to face Adam's other favourite...
The Ultimate Warrior.
Hacksaw Jim Duggan.
Oh, bastard.
Austin proceeded to lose his United States title in 35 seconds.
What? 35 seconds?
Yes, in 1994, Hacksaw Jim Duggan beat Steve Austin on pay-per-view in 35 seconds.
That must be the worst thing ever.
When Austin suffered a triceps injury in May 1995, he was sidelined for a number of months, during which WCW Vice President Eric Bischoff famously fired Austin via telephone. While rehabbing his injury, he was contacted by ECW booker Paul Heyman, who was happy to have Austin solely cut promos on his TV show, even if he couldn't compete in the ring. Known as the Superstar, Austin feuded with the Sandman and Mikey Whipwreck over the ECW World Heavyweight title, but was quickly snapped up by the WWF. Seen as a decent in-ring performer, Vince McMahon hired Austin at the urging of both Jim Ross and Diesel.
Oh, okay, that's interesting. Diesel, I wouldn't have thought that.
Austin debuted for the WWF as the Ringmaster, a name they had trademarked years earlier with nobody in particular in mind for the moniker, on the 18th of December Superstars defeating Matt Hardy. We saw the Ringmaster's run in the Royal Rumble, but Austin's time under this name was limited. Urged by the WWF to suggest a new alias for himself, Austin was inspired by watching a documentary on mafia hitman Richard the Iceman Kuklinski and asked WWF creative for a name that resembled a sort of cold-blooded killer. The suggestions they offered back to Austin are also infamous. Fang McFrost. Ice Dagger. Otto von Ruthless. And Chili McFreeze.
Oh my God, Chili McFreeze!
Can you just imagine how the course of everything changes?
Well, that would kill the character. Yeah. You can't come out like Otto von whatever, you know.
Otto von Ruthless.
Yeah, Otto von Ruthless is a terrible name.
But can you not imagine, like, black trunks, black boots, bald head, goatee, glass smashing, 316, but the guy coming out is called Chili McFreeze?
It's so good.
I kind of can't wait until we do Mankind's debut as well, because the names they suggest for him are almost as good.
Oh, I've not heard those.
Yeah, there's a great selection there. Eric Eargon is one of them. But I know it's meant to be one of those sort of brainstorming sessions, but the fact that you'd even commit pen to paper is like, yeah, we should call this guy Chili McFreeze.
That's an insult, isn't it, really?
Not keen on any of these. Austin took his name from a suggestion by his then-wife to drink his tea before it gets stone cold.
Ah.
And by the 11th of March Raw, Steve Austin was no longer the Ringmaster. Instead, he was Stone Cold Steve Austin.
You must be particularly fond of that, Adam.
Well, because I really like tea.
Yes, because you really like tea.
I'm really like tea.
Do you like stone cold tea?
No, not generally, no. I'm not a big fan of iced tea.
Or chilli McFrozen tea.
Chilli McFrozen tea.
I like hot tea.
Hot tea.
The renamed Austin took on Caribbean sensation, inverted commas, Savio Vega.
The Caribbean sensation.
That's what they call him, isn't it? The Caribbean sensation. On a side note, shown watching this match in the crowd was an Olympian named Mark Henry.
Yeah.
And on another side note, he wasn't either sat with an elderly lady or his sister. The match ended in a double countout, but the two men continued wailing on each other after the bell, despite the officials' best attempts to break them up. When Steve Austin faced Aldo Montoya on the 16th of March Superstars, Savio Vega came down afterwards to stare down Stone Cold. The following week, with Savio Vega scheduled to compete in the semi-finals of the WWF Tag Team Title Tournament, he was in need of a partner due to the suspension of Razor Ramon. Roddy Piper held a random drawing, and who should be drawn as Vega's partner?
Chilli McFreeze. That sounds to me like it wasn't a true random pick. I think it's... If there's one thing that I didn't want to happen.
This makeshift pairing would not progress in the tournament as Austin hit Vega with an axe handle off the top rope, leading to a pin by Skip. A final confrontation between Austin and Vega would air on the 30th of March Superstars, leading to this WrestleMania matchup. Again, not a tremendous amount of build for this one, and as we see, the match is kind of merely here as a backdrop for something else.
Mm.
Back in the arena, ominous music hits, and out comes Ted DiBiase and the million-dollar champion, Steve Austin.
How many people have been the million-dollar champion?
I think just three.
Was Virgil ever the
Virgil million? Won the million-dollar title.
DiBiase's kid had the belt?
Yeah, he had it for a bit as well, didn't he? Mm. DiBiase himself, Virgil, Austin and Ted DiBiase Jr.
Quite a prestigious title.
50% of the time. Doc Hendricks is with Savio Vega and we're shown footage from Superstars that basically sets up this match. Doc asks Savio if he has a counter to the million-dollar dream. Savio doesn't answer the question in the slightest and heads to the ring.
Should be a politician.
I didn't mind his promo. It was all right. It was nonsensical, but it was together.
They're your favourite kind.
Yeah.
Austin attacks to open, but Savio fights back and they exchange fists. Savio hits a side slam and we go back to fists before rolling out of the ring to brawl on the floor. The crowd does ooh for some of the punches they're throwing. Mm. So they're quite snug as well. Back in the ring, they exchange fists. And Austin chucks Savio into the ring post shoulder first. Austin hits a double axe handle for a two and works on Savio's arm. Savio flips back over, looks for a spin kick, misses, but hits a side kick for a two.
That bit was actually quite nice. And I've got to say, I've written that the opening is quite entertaining and lively staff, but I'm guessing I mean lively stuff.
You're correcting yourself.
Yes.
Vince brings us Piper on the phone. This is new gimmick, because this has been going on loads on Raw, like Roddy Piper just calling in via telephone. He's chasing Goldust and we hear police sirens. Austin works on Vega's arm and Savio looks for a clothesline but appears to have hurt his arm, and I thought that was a really nice touch that Austin's worked on his arm, then he's tried to throw a clothesline but it has no impact because it's been worked on. I thought that was good. Savio hits a crossbody off the ropes for a two, following which Austin hits a Luthes press for a two.
Mm.
They exchange pins for a series of twos in a nice sequence which ends when Vega looks for a backslide, but again, his arm hurts.
See, I thought this was the bit with some sloppiness in it.
Oh, I quite liked it.
Well, I thought it looked like it was quite good. I thought if it was executed more proficiently, it would have been good. But certainly, you know, I've not seen this Steve Austin before, so I thought it was quite interesting to see him wrestle in this style.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly different from the sort of 98 to 2001 you'd be familiar with.
Yeah.
Vince tells us they have aerial footage of Roddy Piper. Okay, then. We cut from the match to the sight of a white Ford Bronco driving down an almost empty freeway. When do you think this was taped?
I don't know.
A couple of days prior, like the opening part of the brawl?
Possibly.
Yeah. Try 2 years earlier, June 17th, 1994. Who's driving the white Ford Bronco?
Is it OJ Simpson?
No, it's not OJ Simpson. It's not Roddy Piper. Try a man named Al Cowlings. If I tell you he's friends with American Football Hall of Famer OJ Simpson, does that help? Oh. After Nicole Brown Simpson and bartender Ronald Goldman were found dead at the home of Simpson, June the 13th, 1994, Simpson's lawyers convinced the LAPD to allow OJ to turn himself in on the morning of June the 17th. OJ, however, had other ideas. This white Ford Bronco was spotted driving down Interstate 405 with OJ as a passenger holding a gun to his own head, causing most major news networks in the US to start filming the chase via helicopter. Eventually, police convinced Simpson and Cowlings to pull over and Simpson was arrested.
Had they used this fucking footage?
Why Vince McMahon decided to incorporate this footage into a match featuring Goldust 2 years later is anyone's guess.
What the? That is unbelievable.
That is absolutely disgraceful.
Like two people got murdered.
Yeah.
That's a real thing that happened in real life.
And we'll splice in footage of the police chase.
To use in a homophobic angle between two wrestlers.
Yep.
There are not the right words to describe how long that is.
But it's not even topical anymore. No. Like, yeah.
Yeah. But then, I mean, it was still quite...
No, but even then, it was 2 years... It happened 2 years prior. Mm-hmm. It's not like he's doing this at WrestleMania 10 or SummerSlam 94. No,
they just interrupt Brett's Owen.
Yeah, to show O.J. Simpson driving down the freeway.
Well, not O.J. Simpson.
Sorry, Al Cowlings. Yeah, he was driving the car.
Absolutely weird, yeah.
Yeah, back in the ring. Savio hits a spin kick to take Austin down. No one got killed there. He then looks for a splash from the second rope, but Austin gets his knees up. Savio rolls up Austin with a small package for a two, and Austin dives at Savio from the second rope, but Savio gets a boot up and both men are down. Savio starts to have some sort of fit on the mat as both men get back up. They exchange fists and Austin bumps around for Vega. Vega looks for his spin kick, but Austin moves and a distracted Tim White gets nailed. DiBiase grabs the $1 million belt and looks to distract Savio, but he turns around before Austin attacks. A second distraction is more successful as Austin nails Savio with the belt twice, and Tim White is apparently dead.
Is it Ted DiBiase gets like a whole Coke with ice and chucks it in his face?
But Tim White's down for ages.
And he doesn't flinch at all from that. Maybe he's actually knocked out. I don't know. Or he's just very good at being knocked out as a ref.
Austin chokes Savio as DiBiase, tries to wake the referee up by pouring Coke on him. Tim White does eventually wake up and he lifts Savio's arm once, twice and three times for the win at 10:08.
I think this might be the first time that I've ever seen that as a finish.
What, the arm go down for the third time?
It's just like...
Certainly never see it in a Hogan match.
Post-match, Austin keeps the choke on Savio for a while as DiBiase laughs. Mm. I thought this was okay for what it was.
I wasn't a fan.
No, I wasn't particularly.
Was it WrestleMania worthy? No. Not at all, but essentially it was there to be a backdrop for what was going on with Goldust and Piper. So it needed to be something not massively important that they were taking attention away from. So you couldn't be doing it during like Taker, Diesel or Bret, Shawn or anything
I mean, I thought that this was interesting for me to see Steve Austin in that style. And if Razor Ramon was still around, would I quite like to see something like Stone Cold against Steve Austin? Yes, I would.
Stone Cold against Steve Austin?
I'd love to see that. I'd also like to see Chiller McFreeze against Steve Austin. I'd like to see Razor Ramon against Steve Austin.
Sorry. Okay. Yeah, I imagine that'd be quite good. You get it at WrestleMania 18.
Oh, do you?
Yeah, Scott Hall against Steve Austin. You're looking at me like I'm lying.
I'm trying to think, have I seen WrestleMania 18?
It's the one with Hogan Rock on it.
I have seen it then.
We cut to more familiar-looking footage of Piper in his Bronco as Austin and DiBiase leave the arena.
Okay, here I am back in the dressing room area, Diesel. We're going to go back to February in your house when you had this matchup with Bret Hart. We're going to look at some footage right now of where you were taken inside the ring. The hole was in the ring. You were dragged down underneath by The Undertaker, mind games by The Undertaker. From there, we go to Monday Night Raw. You walked out. The lights were flickering, Diesel. You went to the ring to find The Undertaker. But when you got inside the ring, The Undertaker was gone. More mind games. And then, 2 weeks ago on Raw, you see yourself, Diesel, inside that coffin. More mind games, Diesel. The question I have for you right now, Diesel, what must be going through your mind, and do these mind games by The Undertaker affect you in any way, shape, or form?
Do I look like a man that's affected in any way?
No, you don't.
Exactly. You know, they don't call me Big Daddy Cool for nothing. I don't sweat the little things. I don't sweat the big things either. Undertaker, you're a big obstacle. Tonight, Big Daddy takes cool of you. And then, Sean, good luck. I'll get you next.
Okay, I guess that's what Big Daddy's got to say. Back to you, Jerry the King Lawler. And go ahead, McMahon, you can talk to if you want.
Standing by is Mr. Perfect with Diesel. Diesel cuts a laid-back promo saying he'll take care of Sean after The Undertaker, not predetermining any results or anything there.
Oh, I think Diesel looks like he's got a lazy eye in this promo.
Does he?
Yeah.
Yes, he does.
I think maybe he's so relaxed that one of his eyes is half closed.
He doesn't sweat the small stuff or the big stuff.
Our fourth match is The Ultimate Warrior versus Hunter Hearst Helmsley. The first televised confirmation of the Ultimate Warrior's return to the WWF came during the opening of the 19th of February Raw, with a video package later in the show and an introduction from Vince McMahon, kayfabe explaining that Rowdy Roddy Piper was responsible for the Warrior's return. On the 11th of March Raw, Vince McMahon announced that the Ultimate Warrior's WrestleMania opponent would be Hunter Hearst Helmsley. In reality, Vince McMahon and Jim Hellwig had been in negotiations for the Warrior to return since December, with rumours first surfacing that he would be back at the Royal Rumble in January. Hunter Hearst Helmsley's music hits to somewhat of a large pop.
He's got himself over as a detestable character.
No, I mean like a pop.
Oh.
Well, they know the Warrior's next, don't they?
Yeah.
He enters accompanied by a busty blonde lady that Vince suggests is his most beautiful valet yet.
Yes, Vince is gushing quite a lot about this.
Lawler tells us that the Warrior is now 400 pounds and bold. Genius.
Yes, I like Jerry Lawler.
I thought the crowd gets a bit raucous awaiting the Warriors. Vince tells us that the lovely lady is named Sable.
And I was a little bit disappointed.
I'm keen to hear your thoughts. Go for it.
I just don't think she didn't look like the Sable that I kind of remember, if you know what I mean.
Is it stored in some particular part of your brain?
Well, really different hairstyle.
It was a bit permed.
I think that if I didn't know that Sable was going to be on this, because you posted something up on Facebook.
Some genius comments on that, by the way.
Yeah.
Mostly related to you.
Yeah, but my zip remained closed, actually, for this.
But also the one that's talking about, because you put something about this person debuts on WrestleMania 12 or something. Somebody put, Vince had a debut in his pants. which I thought was a great expression.
But I think that I would have recognised and thought, she looks familiar, but I wouldn't have clocked on that it was Sable until it was mentioned at, like, a minute down into their entrance. Right.
When Hunter's music stops, the crowd pops huge as the classic Warrior theme hits.
This was exciting.
He gets some fireworks around the entrance and runs out to the ring wearing an awesome jacket.
There is one of those Jack's figures with that jacket.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he comes, but he's facing the wrong way around, so you see the back of the Warrior in his jacket.
That's pretty cool.
It's too expensive. I can't get you that one.
He gets more pyro and poses around the ring. Lawler bemoans his sources as the Warrior is not in fact 400 pounds, nor is he bald.
He's definitely not bald. He has the ultimate mullet. I've been waiting a long time for this one.
All right then, go for it.
It's the Ultimate Warrior's mullet. There's nothing else you can say.
Is it mullet of the night?
I'd never normally like to say conclusively, but fuck yeah.
Triple H attacks Warrior from behind with punches and backs Warrior onto the ropes. He sets the Warrior up and hits the pedigree, but Warrior stands right back up.
That no sell of the pedigree is hilarious.
Oh.
What's that noise?
What's going on? Kind of noise.
What do you mean?
I mean, I've not seen the Warrior before, but surely kind of long term. They've actually spent a good few months positioning Hunter Hearst Helmsley quite carefully, and in one fell swoop, you've taken away his biggest weapon.
Yep. It's the Ultimate Warrior, man.
Yeah, fuck it. It's the Warrior.
Yeah, it's the Warrior.
Yeah.
Are you somewhat of a Hunter Hearst Helmsley fan, Paul?
I quite like him, yeah. I mean, I quite like his character at this stage that we've seen, and I think he's been positioned quite strong. Yeah, I think way to undo all that good work.
Way to bring back the Warrior.
Warrior finally takes his coat off and does some dancing. Helmsley attacks again and gets taken down with a trio of clotheslines. He hits a shoulder block and signals for the gorilla press. Warrior hits it and bounces off the ropes for a splash, rolls Helmsley over and covers for the three at 1 minute and 39 seconds.
My note just says, this explains Triple H.
Yeah, I've got that as well. I also put it completes Hunter Hearst Helmsley's audition for the role of the Honky Tonk Man.
Yes. Yeah, very good. Yeah.
For years, I imagined that this was the source of everything wrong with Triple H. Like, if he went to a psychiatrist in 2003 and they tried to work out, like, the root of his problems, it would be like a dark childhood memory that had been unlocked. Like, oh, God, this happened to me.
I was squashed at WrestleMania by the Ultimate Warrior.
Yeah. I wrote lemon or orange.
Do you notice in the crowd there's a sign that just says Ultimate Dad?
No.
Yes. It's on brown cardboard. It's a really cheaply made sign, but, yeah.
Triple H even went so far as to say in 2000 that Warrior had ruined his first Mania experience, and he certainly changed his tune by 2014.
He had, yes.
Thoughts on this match?
Right, the match, not good. It's a squash match, it's not good, but it was the Ultimate Warrior's return. I was quite excited, I was into it.
Did he deliver?
He delivered.
The thing is,
he did a really dangerous looking gorilla press.
All his gorilla presses are really dangerous looking. But the thing is, you're not going to have, and nor would it be the right thing to do, to bring the Warrior back, have him have like a 12-minute competitive match with someone.
Yeah, I think the problem is not in how the Warrior is used. Perhaps Triple H was the wrong person for him to squash. I don't know. But it was probably the correct thing to use the Warrior for.
The thing is, and as we'll see over the few months that he's around, he's very much a man out of time now in that things have changed. And, you know, just looking at the main event and what the main event is, like, that is different from his time.
It's the new generation, baby.
Thanks for that.
So we've brought back the Ultimate Warrior.
For me, it didn't really do its job. I mean, I'm looking at this purely from my ignorant perspective.
Yeah.
My ignorant perspective is I don't really know anything about the guy, and I still really don't know anything about the guy.
Well, watching that match tells you most of what you need to know.
Yeah. Big hair, running to the ring, gorilla press, splash.
Awesome music.
Yeah.
Lots of grabbing energy from the crowd.
Put this into context as well. All the mocking we've seen from the WWF of WCW and the Hookster and the Nacho Man. And this is on a pay-per-view that features the Ultimate Warrior, Roddy Piper, and Jake the Snake Roberts.
Yeah.
You know, these are people that were at WrestleMania 1, 2, 3, 4, that kind of time. Same as Hogan and Savage. And there's an argument to say that, well, Hogan and Savage are main eventers in WCW, whereas in the WWF, those guys aren't positioned as main eventers, but, you know, they're still on the card in pretty prominent positions.
The big draws.
Yeah.
I think the Warrior factor is that nostalgic factor. And, you know, people that remembered Ultimate Warrior would want to see him again. I think you're right in saying, does he fit into this new time? Probably not, actually. Unless you're going to have him just come out and squash random people. But where does he go?
Yeah, where does that lead to?
You can't have him title challenging, really.
Yeah, could he have a competitive 20-minute match with a Bret Hart or a Shawn Michaels? Well, maybe he could. You know, you look at the WrestleMania 7 match between he and Savage, and you put him in there with good workers, and he is capable of performing. But could he contest something like the Iron Man match or something like Bret and Bulldog? Probably not.
I think they've worked quite hard to create a different product as to what existed before in Warrior's time. And to bring Warrior and to try and elevate him to the top, you'd have to rebuild the promotion around
him.
It can never work. He can't fit into that position anymore.
I mean, does he get the biggest pop of the night? Yeah.
Yeah.
Easily.
And that was amazing. And maybe it was just a thing that needed to be done for like one WrestleMania for him to come back and do that. I imagine some people would have bought this
solely to see him.
Because the Warrior was coming back, that was the big draw rather than anything else that was actually on it. So,
yeah, I mean, he kind of fits in that sense as a supplementary draw. You know, obviously it's promoted mostly on the back of Bret and Shawn, secondarily on the back of Taker Diesel. As a third reason to order the pay-per-view, is that good? Yeah, that completely.
Yeah.
But what does he fit in going forward? You know, you'll get to judge that over the next few months.
He's really big and ripped still, but he's not quite super steroid as he was.
No,
previously
he's still on steroids, clearly.
Yeah, he's still big, but he's not just as colossal. I don't know what's changed there. He's more orange.
Fake tan's been invented in the intervening 4 years since he departed.
Yeah, but it's just
David Dickinson taught him everything he knows.
It's an awesome look, though.
Yeah,
I think he just looks so good. Like the face paint, massive hair, tassels, luminous boots. It's crazy, but it works in such a good way.
Are you having some quite good childhood memories here, Adam? I can tell.
I regressed a little bit watching this. Oh, fucking hell, the Ultimate Warrior's back. I don't ever remember him having a coat, but
there was definitely times he had a coat. Mania 7, he had a coat because it had all the awesome painting on it.
It's been a night of ultimate surprises here in the World Wrestling Federation. A wild night, to say the least. But maybe even more wild, ladies and gentlemen, a new superstar in the World Wrestling Federation. I'd like you to meet the wild man, Mark Morrow, ladies and gentlemen. He is in the World Wrestling Federation.
I have arrived. It's been 5 long years that I've been waiting to come to the World Wrestling Federation. And today is the day that I have arrived. And what better day than on the Super Bowl of sports entertainment?
Well, let me ask you something, wild man. The quality that you're going to be facing, the Ultimate Warrior, the Undertaker, Shawn Michaels, Bret the Hitman Hart, are you up to the challenge?
Look into these eyes. Look into these eyes. The fire that burns in these eyes and the wildness that burns in my soul. What an interview here. Punk, you pompous drunk.
The whole thing is your fault. You understand that?
Oh. Come on.
What is this?
Oh, no. Helmsley, look. Helmsley. And Mark Merrill.
Standing by is Todd Pettingill with a newcomer named the Wild Man, Mark Morrow.
Mark Morrow, you say?
Mark Morrow, I say. He looks and sounds an awful lot like Johnny B. Badd.
Yeah.
He would have a mullet of the night had he not unfortunately turned up at the same night as the Ultimate Warrior.
This is very much your iron mullet match.
Yeah, I won a 1 hour Mark Merrow versus Ultimate Warrior hairdressing match.
Merrow had quit WCW on the 11th of March during a discussion in an airport with Eric Bischoff. Merrow's WCW deal had expired at the end of February and he was working without a contract despite the fact he was television champion at the time. Dangerous business. Mm. Merrow had expressed his displeasure with the angle he was working with Diamond Dallas Page and Kimberly, claiming he was told Kimberly would be with him temporarily before switching back to being with DDP, but the switch didn't seem to be happening. Merrow told the Pro Wrestling Torch at the time that he was uncomfortable with an angle where a woman was portrayed like a possession or an item.
Oh. Interesting.
Apparently he'll grow comfortable with that in the next 15 months. After declining an offer to renew his WCW deal and meeting with Vince McMahon alongside his wife Sable, Merrow made the decision to sign with the WWF and this is his first appearance. Similar to the situation WCW will shortly face with Scott Hall, Vince believed he was signing the Johnny B. Badd character, unaware that he was merely signing the performer, not the WCW trademark persona. Mm-hmm. Pettengill suggests that Merrow face a load of babyfaces, which makes it kind of sound like he's going to be a heel. Because he's talking about him facing Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker and people like that, rather than saying, well, you could face Vader or Hunter Hearst Helmsley or whoever. Helmsley interrupts the interview and chastises Sable, so Merrow charges him and they brawl. I guess at least they've got something planned for Helmsley post-Warrior. They're not letting him just sort of fester and it's very much like, here's his next story.
And yeah, you're not going to be in a long-running feud with the Ultimate Warrior trying to get your win back.
Our semi-main event, technically, I guess, is The Undertaker versus Diesel. With the bout between The Undertaker and Diesel for WrestleMania 12 announced at In Your House 6, the feud between the Dead Man and Big Daddy Cool amped up on the following evening's February the 19th Raw. During The Undertaker's match with Tatanka, Diesel came to ringside carrying an axe and dragged a ringside cameraman away with him. Thankfully, instead of murdering him, Diesel made the cameraman film him destroying a casket backstage. After dispatching the corporate Native American, The Undertaker spotted a replay of Diesel's destruction and headed backstage to confront Big Daddy Cool, presumably upset as that particular casket had taken him at least 2 days to finish because it was a pretty good one. When they reached the remains of the casket, Diesel had left and Undertaker had to tolerate a particularly distressed pallbearer. On the 26th of February Raw, Diesel faced off against Bob Holly. During the bout, Diesel appeared distracted, checking the firmness of the canvas in case Taker came up through it, and generally looking around for signs of interference. This was pretty good. Diesel won the match with the jackknife and now appeared cocky and at ease that Taker wouldn't be appearing. As he left the ring, the Undertaker's music hit and the arena lights went out. When they came back on, Undertaker was in the ring, so Diesel charged towards it. The lights went out again, and when they came back on, Diesel was in the ring with no sign of the Undertaker. Taker then appeared on the video screen and claimed that he was the master of mind games. Following the lead of his buddy Razor Ramon, on the 5th of March, Kevin Nash gave his 90-day notice to Vince McMahon that he would be leaving the WWF to accept an offer from WCW. Unlike Ramon, Vince didn't feel like Nash was expendable for WrestleMania and the program between Diesel and The Undertaker continued as planned. On a quick side note, at the time, the word was that Hogan was unhappy with the money being spent on bringing in Scott Hall and Kevin Nash, feeling that the money would have been better spent on signing Yokozuna and or the Ultimate Warrior.
Oh, fuck you, Hulk Hogan.
Wonder why he wants those two brought in.
I need more monsters, brother, so that I can beat them.
Well, no. Warrior pinned him at WrestleMania 6, never got his win back. Yokozuna pinned him at King of the Ring 93, never got his win back.
Well, maybe he could have them both in like a handicap match where he could batter them.
And pin them one on top of the other.
Yeah.
With powder.
Yeah.
Anyway, during a tag team match on the 11th of March Raw between Owen Hart and the British Bulldog and Yokozuna and The Undertaker, Diesel was shown watching backstage. He then wandered to ringside and attacked pallbearer whilst Taker wasn't watching. Diesel then wandered back away. Taker caught on and left the bout to follow Big Daddy Cool backstage. Interestingly enough, the March 18th Raw opened with footage from the March 17th house show at Madison Square Garden, where after a tag team match pitting Bret Hart and The Undertaker against Shawn Michaels and Diesel, Diesel hit Hart and Taker with a chair before doing the same to his supposed best friend, Shawn Michaels. Diesel had been acting pretty heelish for a while, but I guess this kind of fully confirmed his turn. Later on in the show, Diesel faced off against Barry Horowitz. Sadly, there was no Horowitz wins here. However, during the match, pallbearer wheeled out a new casket that was infinitely better than the other one.
Spent a lot of time on it.
On commentary, Vince speculated that The Undertaker was in the casket. Post-match, Diesel grabbed a wrench from the timekeeper's table. Why does the timekeeper have a wrench?
Why not?
And headed to the casket. When Big Daddy Cool opened the casket, he didn't find the Dead Man. He found himself. No, not Glenn Jacobs, but a fucking awesome Madame Tussauds replica of himself.
Is that what it was?
Yeah, it's a waxwork.
Wow. It looks amazing.
It is spot on, which spooked the former WWF champion.
Spooked me, to be fair.
That must have been quite expensive to do.
Mm. If I just found a casket and I opened it and there was a waxwork of Diesel inside.
What about if you got a casket and opened it and there was a waxwork of Paul Scrivens inside?
I'd have said, when did the fine time to bottle that?
On the pre-Mania 25th of March Raw, The Undertaker and Paul Bearer cut a final promo hyping this match, with Bearer claiming that Diesel had robbed Taker of the WWF Championship, and The Undertaker saying that Diesel had made this feud personal by attacking Bearer, and that at WrestleMania, all that would be left is the battered carcass of Big Daddy Cool. I actually really like the build for this.
Yeah.
All the package of stuff looked really good.
We get a quick shot of Piper as Diesel's music hits to boos. He gets even bigger boos when he actually appears. On his way to the ring, Big Daddy Cool quips, "I'm the shit, I'm telling you."
I thought he said something similar to that, but I couldn't quite
remember. Yeah, I'm the shit, I'm telling you.
Well, that's the nice thing to say about yourself.
He says, "I'm the shit, not shit."
Yeah, no, but...
I'm shit.
But still, I wouldn't go around proclaiming to be that.
Okay. You're more humble than Kevin Nash.
I'm not sure I am, but...
He gets more pyro than the Warrior, I thought.
Mm.
Yeah, it's still about... the same amount of pyro Nitro would use if someone went to the toilet, but yeah.
Taker's music hits and the crowd pops, and thankfully he no longer has his facial appliance. Diesel plays it cool on the outside before getting in the ring to attack The Undertaker, hitting a big clothesline in the corner. He tries another, but Taker gets a boot up and hits one of his own before missing an elbow drop. Diesel clotheslines Taker over the ropes, but Undertaker lands on his feet and pulls Diesel to the outside and they brawl. Diesel looks to plant Taker's head into the steel steps, but Taker blocks and completes the move himself. Back in the ring, Taker looks for the tombstone early, but Diesel slips out and Taker hits a crossbody for a two. The pace of this opening is incredible.
It is. And one of the things that I particularly liked was Diesel's facial reaction to the steps spot. And the other thing that I'd note here is that the punches that these two do aren't in the same league as the Yoko Vader punches.
Okay, these are a bit more gentle.
Yeah. Well, it just looks a bit more worked rather than...
I'm just going to hit you. Yeah.
Jerry Lawler is once again great on commentary. He says about Paul Bearer, "Paul Bearer would look okay if it weren't for his face." He says some quite disparaging things about him. He's good.
Taker hits old school and dives at Diesel, but Big Daddy Cool ducks. Taker hits a jawbreaker to Diesel using the ropes and uppercuts Diesel to the outside, who lands on his feet.
Mm.
Taker follows and grabs a chair, but Diesel ducks and Taker clocks the ring post. Diesel whips Taker into the ringside barricade and rams him back first into the corner post.
I thought all this was still quite nicely worked stuff. I think thus far it's been a good match.
Yeah, it's not the slow, dull matches that we've been used to. You put two big people in, we've come to expect a certain pace.
Diesel and Sid, for example.
Yeah, this is definitely a lot better.
Diesel stalks Paul Bearer, who pulls a great face backing off. Mm.
Yeah. Is that the one where he goes, "Oh, no"?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, no!
Lawler speculates that it would take a forklift to pick Paul Bearer up and ram him into the ring post. Diesel poses in the ring to booze and cuts Taker off as he attempts to return to the ring. With Undertaker back inside, Diesel hits a big boot. He follows up with a sidewalk slam for a two. A snake eyes and a boss man attack on the ropes continue the assault and complete Diesel's moveset. More heat for Diesel as he raises his arm to the crowd. Diesel whips Taker into the corner and charges, but Taker fights back. They both attempt a big boot and knock each other down, and I really liked that.
I thought this reminded me a bit of that double Enziguri spot that we speculated upon.
But, yeah, as far as the setup and the timing of that move, which sounds like it could go horribly wrong, they did it about as good as you would assume it could be done.
I'm not sure I've seen that before.
No, I'm not sure I have.
It was pretty cool. It was around about this time that the commentators were saying that Warrior is on the superstar line.
And you said you would pay to call that?
I'd definitely call that.
And what did they say?
Something about distressicity and rocket fuel and spaceships and parts unknown.
Hulk
Hogan.
Okay.
Taker sits up first, but Diesel gets the first attack in and locks in a bear hug. After a fashion, Taker fights out. He heads to the top rope and hits the flying clothesline for a two count.
Good stuff.
Yeah. Taker ducks as Diesel bounces off the ropes, but Diesel hits a quickly delivered jackknife.
And a really good jackknife.
Have we missed the weird, what I've described as a weird, very slow side suplex? Because there was a move there that looked like it was in slow motion.
Wasn't that to get out of the bear hug?
Oh, was that? Okay.
Yeah. On commentary, Lawler calls Diesel a primetime player.
Preempting the primetime players.
He's going to WCW for millions of dollars.
Quickly, we'll delve into the fact that the primetime players are back together.
I'm very happy about that, by the way. It's the right thing to do.
Yeah, the thing is, they split them up to have nothing done with either of the pair of them. So, yeah, may as well just put them back together.
Exactly.
And it gets that theme song back on TV. Mm.
Yeah, which is great.
Maybe we'll get Paul to sing that one day.
Okay.
Big Daddy Cool, however, doesn't go for the cover after the jackknife. He kicks Taker with his foot, urging him to get up.
Well, I wrote nonchalant, but yeah. I wasn't sure about the spelling.
N-O-N-C-H-A-L-A-N-T.
Oh, that's right then.
Yeah.
Diesel's an idiot.
Yeah, why doesn't he pin
him? You've just done your finishing move, which has been set up as being a devastating finishing move. Well, just pin him.
Yeah.
Don't kick him to see if we'll get up.
What happens next?
Taker obliges.
Oh, okay.
Diesel sets up for another jackknife and hits it. He takes another eternity to cover, and when he does, Taker grabs him by the throat.
You've hit it twice.
Cover him.
Definitely pin him now. In fact, two jackknives is probably enough to do one of those cocky pins where you just tread on them. You don't even really need to touch him. Mm.
And thus was the end of the Undertaker's streak via cocky pin.
Yeah, I've got to say, knowing the Undertaker's streak spoiled the outcome of this match.
I've got spoilers for you. It'll spoil the outcome of many future WrestleMania matches.
Damn.
Diesel fights Undertaker off, but Taker grabs the throat again. A third throat grab and Taker gets back to his feet. Diesel quickly hits a backdrop, but Taker gets up. Taker hits a flying clothesline off the ropes and hits a decent chokeslam on Diesel.
That's what I put. Like, it's not the best chokeslam ever, but it's bloody good considering the size of the person that he's chokeslamming.
It's one of these ones where he falls to his knees when he delivers the slam.
Yeah, yeah, but considering the sort of only comparable chokeslam we'd have to this of someone sort of Diesel's size would be the Giant Gonzalez one, and that was fucking terrible.
Yeah, that's awful.
But that may have been more to do with Gonzalez. Taker signals for the end and tombstones Diesel for the three at 16 minutes and 46 seconds.
Decent.
Yeah, really, really quite good.
I've got it down as this was actually a pretty damn awesome big man match.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's hard to do really good, fast-paced matches with lots of spots when you've got two giant people in there.
Yeah.
And this one delivered.
Definitely the best Undertaker match we've seen so far.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Considering Diesel's other good matches had come against kind of smaller guys that lead him through the match, this was surprisingly good. You know, where Diesel shined is against people like Bret and Shawn.
But perhaps Undertaker books the trend. He's a big guy with a good wrestling brain on him.
The opening couple of minutes as well was an insane pace for two guys their size. Mm.
No, it's one of these things that it wasn't a match that blew me away, but I was definitely impressed with it. Definitely better than I would have thought.
Yeah, no, by no stretch of the imagination am I saying it's five stars, but for two guys of their size and certainly considering the matches we've seen them have, I mean, Diesel had a shitty 95 when he wasn't in the ring with Bret or Shawn, and Taker just had an awful 1995. you know, this was way, way exceeding expectations. Yeah. And it's definitely worth watching.
Yeah.
It's not 16 minutes you'll waste of your life watching this.
No.
Todd is standing by in security control as we see the car chase come back to the arena. Piper's car has blood on the door. Goldust wanders inside the building with Marlena and Piper follows. They make it into the arena as the crowd chants Roddy. Piper wails on Goldust as they roll in the ring. Goldust kicks away at Piper's leg, taking him down. Lawler asks if they should get a referee, and Vince tells him there's no such thing.
Well, referees don't exist.
Yeah, like he doesn't say, oh no, this match doesn't have a referee. He just says, there's no such thing.
There
definitely is. Earl Hebner definitely exists. Goldust does some sexual taunting for heat as the Piper chants continue. Goldust appears to set Piper up for a pile driver, but instead fondles his bottom.
Yeah.
It happened.
Goldust rips off Piper's shirt and chokes him with it. You'd get fired for that in 2010. He wraps Piper's knee around the ring post, but it only serves to fire Piper up. Goldust looks for his drop-down punch, but Piper just sort of falls away, which was really odd-looking. Goldust mounts Piper and does some more sexual taunting, looking to kiss Roddy, but Piper pushes him away. Goldust goes to the top rope, but Roddy shakes it, crotching the bizarre one. Goldust with headbutts and a kiss.
You see, the thing is, Goldust's assault is not so much wrestling, it's just
rape.
It's more of like sexual harassment, isn't it?
Yeah. Paul, your feelings?
I don't know what's going on anymore.
this was weird. And at this point, I thought, this is as weird as this can fucking get.
It isn't.
Piper, not so happy about the kiss, goes mental and batters Goldust, grabbing him by the balls before kneeing him in them. He spanks Goldust and rips off his costume to reveal ladies' underwear.
Yeah, this was the point that I think made my brain break. What the fuck?
Piper kisses Goldust back. Has he figured out he's gay or something?
I put this like, Piper touches Goldust balls, then he spanks him, and then he kisses him.
I think he's reciprocating Goldust's feelings.
Yeah, maybe he's gay. I don't know. An angry gay, but...
Gay, nonetheless. Yeah. Piper kisses Goldust back, and strips Goldust down to his panties. Yes, panties.
He struggles to get his legs out of the costume.
Yeah. One more knee to the balls, and Goldust rolls out of the ring, where Marlena attempts to cover him up, and they leave. Piper's music hits, so I guess that means he wins.
Yeah.
That was the stipulation of the match. You have to strip your opponent down to their panties, and they have to leave the ring. They forgot to mention that on commentary.
Piper celebrates in the ring with his son.
Yeah. Just adding layers to the weirdness.
Piper hits Jimmy Snooker's pose to close, I spotted as well.
This was the weirdest thing that we've seen yet on this podcast, right? It's got to be.
Yeah, I'd go with that.
I was going to say the weirdest thing ever, but that old woman gives birth to a hand, and that's weirder than this, right?
Yeah, probably. I honestly cannot explain this, how this functions, what this means.
And I can't really judge it, because I wouldn't say that it's...
good or bad.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to go back to this. What was wrestling thinking?
I will say there is something possibly a bit weirder next month.
Fuck off.
Yeah, that's the end of the Hollywood Backlot Brawl. There's not many more of them, funnily enough. Or in fact, any more of them. So, there you go. It's definitely unique, I'll give it that.
Yes, that's the one thing that we can say about it, definitely.
Whether you want to take that as a compliment or not is up to you or them.
What about the Iron Man matchup? The most maneuvers, the most finishes, if you will, the most decisions, as it were, in this Iron Man matchup. The man who has the most decisions will be victorious.
Vince claims that the person with the most maneuvers...
You can't write it, can you?
The most finishes, if you would, the most decisions, as it were, wins the Ironman match. So if we're judging this on the most manoeuvres, I can see the final score being 1,345 to 2,978, if that's the case.
Vince is on fire, this pay-per-view.
Two athletes, two men, 1 hour. For Shawn Michaels and Bret Hart, this is what it all comes down to. Throughout their World Wrestling Federation careers, both superstars have traveled down similar roads. Through heart, determination, and pure blood, sweat, and tears, both men have made it to a point to simply be the best they can be. But now the question is, who is the best? Shawn Michaels, the 12-year-old boy from San Antonio, Texas, who had a dream of one day becoming the World Wrestling Federation champion. Trained by the legendary Jose Lothario, the flamboyant and charismatic Shawn Michaels never stopped working to achieve his goal, sweating his way through the ranks for over 7 years. Through the good and the bad, Shawn Michaels continued to follow that dream. The dream that would eventually lead him to Anaheim, California, and WrestleMania 12. Bret Hart, the rugged technician whose formal training came in a dungeon in Calgary, Alberta, Canada. Under the guidance of his father, Stu, Bret learned how to methodically and technically wear an opponent down to the breaking point. For over 11 years, Bret Hart has thrilled Federation fans, giving his all, en route to becoming a 3-time World Wrestling Federation champion. The excellence of execution, and most importantly, the best there is, the best there was, and the best there ever will be. The best. The Iron Man. The champion.
The first time ever, I can't really think of a whole lot left to say. Everybody knows the story. Now it's just time for the final chapter.
Well, you know, for me, it's just the whole thing's finally coming to a head, you know. It's do or die, and, you know, 60-minute Iron Man match, we're going to find out just how good Shawn Michaels is. I think everyone's going to see just how good I am. And I think the way I look at it is one man's sunset is another man's dawn. And tomorrow morning, I just want to wake up tomorrow morning with this.
We get one final video package for the Iron Man match, and that appears to have Enigma in the background. Do you remember Enigma from the mid-90s?
No.
It was sort of Enya-esque, sort of atmospheric. Okay. But it definitely has some odd music in the background. And we get a couple of quick final comments from Brett and Sean, and we are set. The build for the main event of WrestleMania 12 began in earnest on the February 26th Raw with an in-ring promo hosted by Vince McMahon featuring both Shawn Michaels and Bret the Hitman Hart. Shawn claimed that nobody in the building had more respect for Bret Hart than he did, with Bret responding that Shawn was one of the best wrestlers he'd ever seen. Bret emphasised that it wasn't his job to beat Shawn, it was Shawn's job to beat him, getting somewhat of a mixed reaction for that particular comment. Brett also claimed that he was like the Energizer Bunny and that he could keep on going and going and going.
It's a grand claim.
That's the sort of thing that Sean would claim, but in a very different way.
Rowdy Roddy Piper then interrupted the segment and chastised the crowd for booing either of the men in the ring. The crowd then booed him for that. Piper also got in an amusing line about how he heard Bret Hart beat Roddy Piper once, but he wasn't sure about that as he wasn't there. Piper said he didn't want the match to end with a single lucky fall, instead that the bout would be a one-hour Ironman match, with the man who won the most falls in that period declared the winner. During Sean's match against the 123 Kid on the 4th of March Raw, we cut to an inset video of Bret watching the bout, and later in the same show, Sean would wander ringside to watch the Hitman take on Hunter Hearst Helmsley. Nothing much happened. Sean literally just watched the match and then left for the back when it ended. On the 11th of March Raw, the WWF presented footage of Shawn Michaels training in Texas with his mentor and trainer, Jose Lothario, followed by a short video of Bret Hart training in Calgary with his father, Stu. Sadly, not Bruce. More training footage of both men aired on the March 18th Raw, with Hart referencing that for the first time he felt a tidal wave of momentum against him, referencing Shawn's popularity. Brett said that he didn't like Shawn dancing and felt that fans were better off looking up to him rather than Michaels. On the 25th of March Raw, Shawn Michaels came to the ring to face Leaf Cassidy with his click cam, where he filmed the audience as he entered. This basically showed that Raw was obviously pre-taped, as it spliced in the footage from the camera into the show. So basically, Shawn comes out holding a camcorder that's clearly not connected to anything, and all of a sudden you can see it on the live television broadcast before the invention of Wi-Fi.
Yes, you would definitely need some kind of cable.
He introduced his mentor, Jose Lothario, to watch the match, and Vince informed us that Jose would also be ringside at WrestleMania. For some reason, Jose was dressed as a referee. He just came out in like a black and white stripy shirt.
On the subject of Jose Lothario, because I don't really know him, is he a big enough deal to actually add to this whole angle?
Not really.
Okay.
Bret Hart decided that he wanted to watch the match also and joined Vince on commentary, with Lawler leaving the announce booth claiming he'd left his car lights on. Brett was mildly nicer about Sean on this night, complimenting Sean for his speed, but claimed there wasn't nine people in Syracuse that could do to him what had been done to Sean. A third viewer came out to watch this match, Michael's former Rockers partner and Cassidy's current new Rockers partner, Marty Jannetty. And this is about the closest to main event status as he'll ever reach.
There was a lot of suggestions for Marty Jannetty reaching main event status as a
boyhood dream. As a boyhood dream, yeah. When Marty attempted to interfere in the match, Brett left the announce booth and pulled him away, giving Sean the opportunity to sweet chin music Leaf Cassidy for the win. Post-match, Sean left the ring and confronted Brett for no real reason other than to sell a bit of tension between them. Returning to Vince, Brett derided Sean's gratitude and said that at WrestleMania he would give Sean the worst 60 minutes of his life. Later on in the show, more training vignettes aired, and in the final segment, the You Start the Fire music video for Bret Hart aired. Quick thing on that we didn't mention in the Slammies episode that I audibly worked out while editing the Slammies episode. You Start the Fire is Ken Shamrock's theme tune.
Which is really weird, because I didn't like You Start the Fire, and I love Ken Shamrock's theme tune.
Adam sort of came into the room as I was putting that into the episode. I was like, right, listen to this. And he's like, yeah, it's the Bret Hart song. Then I went to YouTube, I was like, and listen to this. And he was like, oh, that is the same.
So it turns out with the Bret Hart song, what I really don't like about it...
is the lyrics.
Is the lyrics, and the fact that it doesn't have any of those chimes on it, which I think really make the...
The chimes do make it, I'll be honest with it. Yeah, that's a
genius level on it.
The idea to do this as an Iron Man match belonged to Pat Patterson.
Okay,
fair enough, Pat.
This was the WWF's first attempt at an Iron Man match, but not the first on US television. WCW had held two 30-minute Iron Man matches prior to this one, one between Ricky Steamboat and Rick Rude in 1992, and one between Dustin Rhodes and Rick Rude in 1993. Hour-long matches were relatively common in Japan at the time, and in fact I watched a rather exciting one-hour match between Manami Toyota and Kyoko Inui the other day from 1995 that's well worth watching. I might post it on the Facebook.
Oh, okay.
It was very good. Excited for the Iron Man match?
No, because
no, yeah.
The reason that I wasn't is you posted on Facebook.
About whether we would do it as a commentary.
Yeah, so you kind of said, well, some people have asked for this. What do the rest of you think?
Let's get a consensus.
Yeah, yeah, and I think there was a few that kind of liked the idea of this live commentary, but mostly it was quite negative, and there was a lot of comments saying this match is generally boring until the last couple of minutes.
Right.
So that kind of made me think, well, I won't pretty much like it for most part then.
I'm of a similar thinking. I knew that, it's an hour-long match, yada, 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 and you'd put it up, and then lots of people have said, this match is boring. So my initial thoughts of going into it was this will be a majority dull match.
The odd thing is, we did actually do a live commentary for this WrestleMania 12. You may not have noticed, we did the Hunter Hearst Helmsley Ultimate Warrior match as a live commentary. So we kept the idea, just changed the bout. Howard Finkel tells us that Gorilla Monsoon is now officially the WWF president. Presumably Piper's had to step down now that he's been stripping down his employees to their underwear.
Yeah, it's not the sort of thing you want in your company leader.
I've definitely lost jobs for that previously. Sean's music hits and out comes a rather old-looking Shawn Michaels.
Yes. Oh, I really didn't know what was happening here.
Shawn Michaels is an old Mexican man.
No, wait, it's the boy toy, Jose Lothario. Jose enters the ring and points to the top of the arena. What's up there? It's Sting. No, wait, it's Shawn Michaels who rappels down into the crowd. Silly entrance, good entrance.
I thought it was really good, I'll be honest with you.
Silly and good.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, I thought this looked cool.
It also says this man has to win.
Yeah. Otherwise, he looks like a massive bellend for going to great lengths to enter like this. Yeah.
The Jose Lothario entering first in that manner to his music. You should have had Jose Lothario coming out without music.
Right.
You shouldn't have him coming out to Sexy Boy.
Or you should have had him come out in Sean's outfit.
You should have had him slide down that fucking rope.
Or maybe Sean should have just walked in and Jose Lothario should have come across the side.
Scared old Mexican man rappels down from the top of the arena. Vince references Sean having the best slamming jamming entrance, and Sean fights off the clip.
Sorry, the best slamming jamming entrance.
Sean fights off the clique to get to the ring and does some dancing. Brett's music hits and out comes Stu. He points to the roof and Brett enters via helicopter. No, just kidding. Brett walks to the ring. Again, it kind of sort of tells you the result, doesn't it, really?
Yeah.
But
I did notice as Brett's walking to the ring, there's someone with a sign that just says, shit man Brett Hart.
Yes, there is. Did you see that?
No, I didn't. Which,
it's simple but funny.
Not very nice.
Not very nice at all.
Brett does get some pyro, but if the entrances don't give away who's winning this, I don't know what will. Earl Hebner sets up the Urn Man match.
That's what the Undertaker has.
That's what he says, though, isn't it? He says the Urn Man match. He says the man who wins the most decisions will win, so the manoeuvres concept is out the window.
But Vince is wrong.
Earl explains the various ways decisions can be won. Brett gives the belt a kiss and gives it to Earl Hebner. Always a bad idea. Brett gives his shades to Blade, and we're ready.
But he also shakes Gorilla Monsoon's hand, but there's no other handshaking that went on, as far as I noticed.
No. So, we get some mat wrestling to start, and it's very clear from the opening that the pace of this is going to be different from anything else we normally see.
Yeah.
Sean gets the advantage on the mat, and Brett looks miffed. He should be the one getting the mat advantage.
It's a little bit like that 1-2-3 kid Bret Hart
match,
where he gets flipped off and he sort of looks a bit like, okay.
It was, and this was interesting for me to see in the sense that I wouldn't really associate Shawn Michaels with that style of wrestling. So that's interesting to
But in the sort of build-up to this match, they're very much focused on, and Bret himself is very much focused on, Shawn's sort of Mexican style of wrestling and flying all over the place. And I think this was there to signal that, hang on, actually, he studied what you do.
Yeah.
Which I liked, okay. Bret puts a headlock on and tenaciously won't let go, and a handy clock appears on the screen.
Yeah.
Sean tries various ways to put distance between he and Brett, but Brett keeps the headlock firmly on, switching to a front face lock with a trip when Sean tries to escape. I thought that was nice, where he sort of rolls along his back and puts it back on. Sean eventually makes his way out and puts on an armbar to some boos. Are the crowd booing what they consider another rest hold?
Possibly. I can't imagine them booing Sean. Yeah.
It's not a particularly hot crowd, I will say that.
No.
No, they've been mostly, apart from when the Warrior came out, they've been mostly sedate.
Mostly tepid, I would say.
Maybe these are all people who haven't been to a wrestling pay-per-view since 1991, and all they want to see is the Ultimate Warrior.
And big muscle-bound jerks. Yeah,
and everything else is just a bit confusing to them, especially that Piper Goldust match.
That confused everyone, that's fine.
Lawler suggests if there was a geriatric match between the Hookster and the Nacho Man, then we could have a Jurassic Park match between Stu Hart and Jose Lothario.
Could well happen.
You can't have Lawler on commentary with anything to do with Brett without him just ripping on his parents loads.
Lawler spots Stu in the crowd and is once again ecstatic, asking where Helen is. And Helen is there, but they don't really show her. Our first big spot comes when Brett whips Sean to the corner, charges, and Sean head scissors the hitman to the outside. Brett regroups on the outside before re-entering and trying to throw Sean to the outside, but Sean skins the cat, gets back in, and slaps the armbar back on.
That was nice, though. The skinning of the cat was very smooth. It is a good move.
And to be fair, Brett should know that you can't throw Sean over the top rope and look away.
Yeah.
You have to confirm that he is out. Brett pushes Sean away and gets a knee to the gut to take the advantage. Brett goes for a chin lock on Sean, and he sort of, at various points in this match, Brett jaws with Jose Lothario, sort of smack-talking. Sean jawbreakers his way out, and it's armbar time again, and Vince claims that if the match was judged on points, currently you'd have to award it to Shawn Michaels. Brett kips up his way out of it and looks for the sharpshooter, but Sean makes the ropes. When Sean gets up and turns around, Brett clotheslines him to the outside for some booze.
Is that the bit where, though, with the sharpshooter attempt, where I've written wriggly and spit?
Yes.
Because he wriggles out and spits everywhere.
Brett follows HBK to the outside and attacks, but gets shoved into the ring post. Brett falls into the lap of the timekeeper, and Sean looks to super kick the hitman.
Well hang on. He just sits on the timekeeper. He sits on his knee.
Yeah.
It's story time.
Yeah, it kind of very much is. You made it kind of seem like it was just like a natural thing that just kind of happened just through the course of the match.
He just sits on his knee.
Sean looks to super kick the hitman, but Brett moves and Sean clocks the poor timekeeper.
Well, I've got to say, I think people are probably generally right not to ask us to do it as a live commentary. But one thing that was probably exciting was when that happened, we both marked out big time, didn't we, Adam?
Yeah. So I'm just thinking about, I mean, Sean's thinking, all right, I kick people in the face.
That's my deal.
That's what I do. And, you know, if I kick Brett in the face, I need to make sure I don't kill him because I've still got to wrestle him. But this guy, I don't care about this guy. I'm just going to leather him. And he just twats him in the face.
It's
good spot, though.
Really good, yeah.
That is a good spot.
I would have liked to know something about the medical condition of that timekeeper.
But the thing was that it's kind of quite clever, because, again, in an hour-long match, you want to have exciting stuff happening, but you don't want to ruin your two competitors early in the match. So something like this, where you've not necessarily got outside interference, but you've got somebody else to take the move, is genius.
What we're essentially saying is that timekeeper is cannon fodder for sweet chin music.
It's like, what's his name? What's Del Rey's announcer? Alberto.
Del Rio.
I just like Del Rey so much, just had to mention him.
Roberto Rodriguez.
That's it. It's like
the bumps he takes,
in that TLC match.
Yeah. The competitors head back into the ring, leaving poor Mark Yeaton dead on the outside. Brett with a chin lock as we see multiple replays of the kick. Brett urges Earl to ask Sean, claiming this isn't a staring contest. So where's Roddy Piper in his microphone when you actually need him? Sean escapes the chin lock with an arm drag, but appears rattled and can't take advantage, allowing Brett to slap it back on. Sean fights away again, hits Brett with a drop kick, and he goes back to the armbar. Shawn Michaels knows 1,004 holds, and they are all armbars.
Armbar.
Brett gets a sweet roll to get out of the armbar and into a headlock, but Sean transitions back to the armbar once again.
That was a really nice little
That was
sequence.
Awesome. Brett gets to his feet and backs Sean into the corner, elbowing Sean in the face and drilling Michaels with uppercuts. Brett looks to whip Sean into the corner, but Sean reverses, knees Brett in the gut and rams Brett into the ring post shoulder first before wrapping his arm around it. Sean, on the outside, tells the cameraman to get the fuck out of his way.
I didn't spot that either.
Yeah, glad
I'm really
to see
unobservant. I just don't spot anything.
Glad to see his paddies are still there.
I will point out that at this point, Mrs. Scrivens has joined us while we're watching.
Yeah, I watched this alone and you two watched this together.
She had returned from 50 Shades of Grey to come into something more erotic.
Piper versus Goldust.
And I mean, I've made a note of this later on, but I'll point out now that she thought that one of these people was Randy Orton. And she only realised with about 5 minutes left. She was literally there for about 45 minutes of this match without realising that one of the competitors just wasn't Randy Orton.
You have like random close-ups on. She said, which one's the good-looking one? Where's he? And eventually, it took us a couple of minutes to work out that, you mean Randy Orton, don't you?
Randy Orton's never had long hair.
No, but no, that didn't stop his experience.
You also commented that it wasn't good because there was no ladders and no thumbtacks.
Yes, he did comment.
I do find that really odd that that's what she likes.
Well, I think it
comes... Maybe this 50 Shades of Grey thing's actually got some mileage in it.
She's going to have sex with you on thumbtacks.
The first...
barbed wire bed match.
The first match... In fact, I think the first two matches that I ever showed Mrs. Scrivens were the Undertaker, Mankind, Hell in a Cell, which is probably quite common.
Yeah,
the second one was Randy
Orton, Cactus Jack.
Yeah.
This conditioning her to think that wrestling matches involve people being chucked from great heights or being slammed onto thumbtacks.
How did she initially respond to your revelation that you're a wrestling fan?
I don't know if it was a revelation, because I knew her for some time before we started going out. So I think she already knew that dirty little secret.
How did she respond to your indoctrination?
She liked those. She thought they're quite entertaining. She's quite up for things with lots of big spots in.
But not technical wrestling?
Not technical wrestling, no.
Okay.
Going to make some sort of sexual comment there, but I don't know how you go for it.
Say it and see what
that's what she says.
Just... No work up to it.
Yeah.
Straight in. Done. There is no involved.
Paul is now attacking Adam for degrading the good name of Mrs. Scrivens.
Oh, I'm sorry, Paul.
Inside, Sean hits a shoulder breaker, an axe handle and a hammerlock slam. Michaels works on Brett's shoulder, hitting a jumping arm breaker to cheers before heading back to the armbar to booze. Brett breaks free, dropping Sean throat first over the second rope, and Brett monkey flips Sean into the corner, and Lawler sells that he hits the ring post, but I don't really think that he did. Brett covers for a two. A bulldog by Brett, and he heads to the top rope, but Sean catches him. Brett fights back, though, and drives his knee into the back of Sean's head, taking Michaels and Earl Hebner down.
Mm. And one of the things that I'd say is, because this is around about halfway through, this is pretty much 30 minutes... The crowd are surprisingly hot at this stage.
You think?
Yeah, they are. They go from...
I think there's definitely a rumbling bed, I would say.
There's bits where it's just complete apathy.
But I think that's when they work out there's going to be no falls.
I don't know. I think what happens is there's just these periods of the match, which I don't know why necessarily, but they seem to kind of get quite into it and it dies down again.
Yeah, I kind of think about 30, 35 minutes into it when they work out, wait, this is going to be nil-nil, or, you know, the only fall we'll get is right at the end. I think that's when they lose interest a little bit. Sean catches a power slam for a two, which gets gasps from the audience, and Brett gets a pile driver, which Sean takes perfectly.
Yeah, good pile driver.
But Michaels kicks out at two to huge boos. And yeah, are they booing because they want Brett to win or just because they want to see a fall? Mm-hmm. I'd argue it's the side of they just want to see a fall. Brett goes back to the top, and this time Sean manages to slam him off. Sean hits a Hurricane Rana and punches Brett in the face. Sean gets a two from a backbreaker and sets up for the sweet chin music, but Brett rolls to the outside and the crowd boos. And yeah, okay, they're definitely booing because they want to see a fall.
Mm.
Sean heads to the top, and as Brett walks around the ring, Michaels dives to the outside, which does pop the crowd. Yeah. I thought it was a great dive.
Yeah.
Sean rolls Brett back in the ring, breaking the count, and he hits a crossbody from the top, but Brett rolls through for a two count. Both men look for a backslide, but Sean flips over and gets a small package for a two. Smooth.
Yeah, it's good stuff.
Sean hits a perfect plex for a two.
Oh, yeah, he did.
Is it called perfect plex?
Yeah, he calls it a perfect plex on commentary.
Yeah, that's right.
Sean goes for a sleeper hold to mild boos. As Brett tries to fight out, Sean tosses him into the corner and reapplies the move. Brett fights out again, and Sean charges him in the corner, but Brett flips Michaels out of the ring, leading to an odd shot where the cameraman gets taken down, except the replay shows that he doesn't. He just turns the camera around.
That's a weird-looking thing, because it does look like he's completely wiped out, but then... They shouldn't have shown the second angle for that, I think, because it kind of takes away the mystique.
But the bump's incredible.
Yeah, it is. The height that he gets on, it's insane. And considering there's still, I wrote down, 23 minutes to go at this point, that's a really big spot to be taking.
It's a dangerous one to take. You know, you've still got to go 20 minutes after this.
Yeah.
Was it the Jarrett match? There was a similar one to that where he sort of went absolutely flying over the top.
And I think we've pointed this out before, is that the thing that eventually does Shawn Michaels back in looks nothing near as elaborate as something like this. This looks mental.
This looks like it would cripple you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If someone said he broke his back doing that, I'd say, That is thoroughly believable.
But the casket shot, you wouldn't, yeah.
Yeah, it just looks like just innocuous. A glancing blow, yeah.
On the outside, Brett rams Michaels back across the ring post. Back inside, Brett punishes Sean's lower spine, which makes sense given what damage has been done to him and what his finisher is. They have a messy exchange mid-ring, which ends with Brett hitting a backbreaker. Brett whips Sean into the corner and he flips himself onto the top rope. So Brett hits his top rope backdrop. A genius, that, because I love the way once he realizes Sean is up there, he legs it up to do it. There's no considering of movement. It's just straight up there, hit it, because he realizes that Sean's in a vulnerable position. Brett gets a two and the crowd boos some more. Brett applies a sort of camel clutch that involves just sort of sitting on his back, and it's more of a chin lock than a camel clutch.
Yeah, the arms aren't around the knees, are they?
Sean sells his back, but fights out and gets a sunset flip for a two. Brett hits the Russian leg sweep for a two. Michaels then gets whipped across the ring and launches himself to the outside, clocking Jose Lothario along the way. Second big bump over the top to the outside.
And a big bump from an old Mexican man as well.
Mm.
Brett whips Sean into the steel steps and takes out Jose again. He really eats it in this match.
He's earning his crust, isn't he?
I still just don't think adding that to Shawn Michaels' character sort of package does anything for him.
I can't work out the purpose, because like I asked you earlier, I was thinking, is he actually a big deal and I've just never heard of him and it's going to add something in that?
No, it's not like, say, Vader having Harley Race in his corner. It's nothing like that.
Is it simply there to...
So he can point to the ceiling when he comes in.
Or to make Sean less of a prick.
I think it's to make Sean appear kind of
arrogant dickhead. He's sympathetic. He's got this trainer.
I guess he's there to remind us of the boyhood dream aspect of the story.
Absolutely.
To put Sean in context of still being a relatively young man, although he's been around a while.
I mean, he's only 30 here.
This is his dream, I guess.
Lawler likes this version of Bret Hart, apparently, taking out old Mexicans. Brett jaws with Jose as he rolls Sean back inside. Brett hits a belly-to-belly suplex for a two. Sean occasionally gets hope spots with fists and chops, but Brett keeps the Heartbreak Kid down. Brett looks for a suplex, but Sean slides out and rolls Brett up for a two. The Hitman kicks Michaels away, throwing him to the outside again. Brett takes a run-up and toe-pays through the top and middle rope onto Michaels on the outside. Good stuff.
Yeah.
Well, the pace is really picking up now, isn't it?
This time, Brett decides he'll take the count-out victory and leaves Sean in the aisle as El Hebner counts. Which, again, nice touch. Like previously, they've sort of decided to roll people back in and go for the pin or submission. Mm. But I think we're down to probably about 15 minutes by this point, and
I think it's less than that.
Might be less than that. He leaves him and just thinks, fuck it. You know, a count-out is still a win.
Yeah.
Sean makes it back to the ring in time, though, and Brett tries to suplex him back in, but Sean slides out again and applies a waist lock. Brett reverses and hits a sweet German suplex for a two. They angrily exchange blows and Brett settles into his pseudo camel clutch with the timer down to 10 minutes remaining. Sean fights to his feet as the fans cheer and they hit a double clothesline spot, taking both men down. Back to their feet, Brett looks for the superplex and hits a textbook version of it. From the top rope as well. No one's on the second rope on this one.
No.
Yeah.
Brett looks for the sharpshooter, but Sean blocks him, kicking away at Brett's face. Brett instead tries to apply a figure four, but I'm not sure if he sort of muddles it or just settles for a one-legged crab.
Yeah, he starts it and then just changes his mind.
One-legged crab is easier, I suppose.
Yeah.
Brett hits another backbreaker and looks for an elbow from the second rope, but Sean gets his foot up. Earl Hebner begins the count on both men. With them up, Sean hits a dropkick, knocking Brett into the corner, and Sean whips Brett hard across the ring with the Hitman taking his trademark chest-first bump into the corner.
That always looks good.
Mm.
Sean hits a flying forearm and kips up off-camera to a mixed response.
Why was it a mixed response?
Because... Are the crowd more Brett or are they more Sean?
I'd say it was a relatively even split.
Mm.
But I think at this point, I think you're right that they've not seen anyone get a point.
Sean body slams Brett and goes to the top rope, hitting a spinning axe handle for a two. Sean with a suplex and he heads back to the top rope, nailing a diving elbow. Mm. Pretty nice one.
Mm. Yeah, there's lots of high flying at this stage.
Michaels hits a gut wrench suplex for a two and lands a moonsault press from the top rope for a two. Less than 2 minutes remain. Sean dives off the second rope looking for a Hurricane Rana. Brett appears to attempt to turn it into a powerbomb, but Sean rolls him through for a two count. Sean slams Brett and looks to head to the top rope, but appears to be too fatigued with less than a minute remaining. Brett gets to his feet and catches a diving Sean, locking him in the sharpshooter. With 30 seconds left, Sean just has to hold on, but at the same time, Brett just has to keep that, because technically, if it's a draw, he retains his belt. The crowd counts down the timer and the bell rings, leading Brett to believe he's technically won. And Brett leaves the ring while Monsoon converses with referee Hebner. Howard Finkel tells us Monsoon has ordered the match to continue under sudden death rules, and Brett rightfully seems miffed.
Yeah, he does a good bit of mouthing off, actually. But you notice how he's quite clever. He's got a bit of snot on his face.
Yeah.
But before the camera gets too close, you just wipe it off. He's learned.
From Owen's mistake.
Yeah.
Brett heads back to the ring and jaws with Monsoon while Michaels recovers. Brett asks for the bell to ring and pounds on Sean. Brett whips Sean to the ropes and delivers a back body drop. Backbreaker by Brett, and Sean avoids a Brett charge in the corner, nailing Sweet Chin Music, but he's too beaten down to make the cover.
It wasn't the crispest Sweet Chin Music, the first one.
Certainly wasn't the Timekeeper Chin Music, as I'll now refer to that.
Both men struggle to their feet, and Sean hits a second Sweet Chin Music for the three at 61-52. Thoughts?
I thought it was... It's difficult because I had this expectation, as I say, from the comments on the page, I had this expectation that it wasn't going to be good.
Right.
And I surprisingly enjoyed it. I enjoyed it much more than I thought I would, considering... I mean, I thought... before I had the comments, I thought I would enjoy it because it's Brett and Sean.
Yeah.
And then I thought I wouldn't, and then I did enjoy it. That was kind of my pattern.
I kind of mirror what Scribbins is saying. That I went in with low expectations, but actually, I really liked it.
It's one of those Marmite matches, I think.
Yeah.
You either really think it's a masterpiece or you think it's the most boring thing ever committed to pay-per-view.
I think watching it with people was a good idea. I think that made it much better. Watching it on my own, I might have thought slightly different about it.
I don't know, because I watched it on my own, and it's a good few years since I've seen this, and I was surprised by how gripped I was with it. Mm. Again, I knew I had an opinion of the match in that I didn't think it was boring, but again, seeing all the comments from people that it's terrible and dull and blah, 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 had led me more to the side of, well, is this going to be boring? Have I misremembered it? But no, I really do genuinely like it.
I like it. I can see why people wouldn't. Yeah, but I do like it.
I can certainly... It's not one of these matches where I think, oh, what are people thinking if they don't like it? I do understand why it wouldn't be the thing for certain people.
Yeah. I think it's... You had to announce it as an Ironman match if you were intending on it going 60 minutes.
Yeah.
Because if you started your main event an hour and a half into the show, which is about when it starts...
Yeah.
You'd have everyone going, hang on, what's up here?
Yeah.
Because technically, you could be finished by 2.25 hours and then, I don't know, you put on Aldo Montoya versus Isaac Yankem or something.
Yeah.
So
I can't believe they did that.
So if you're going to have it go the hour, you have to announce it prior to that as being an Ironman match.
Yeah.
Sean is on his knees in the ring as Earl Hebner hands him the belt and Jose Lothario enters the ring. There's definitely some sort of exchange as Sean says something to Earl, who then clearly says something to Brett. The story here is that Sean tells Earl to tell Brett to get the fuck out of my ring. Sean, for years, denied this, but on the Greatest Rivalries DVD set, which Adam and I watched a bit of the other night, when face-to-face with Brett, Sean seems to sort of nonchalantly accept Brett's version of events whilst simultaneously claiming he doesn't really remember what he said.
Hmm. I think Sean's done a very good thing of basically creating two people. There was there was Shawn Michaels before he returned, and then the Shawn Michaels from when he returned currently.
I just feel Brett feels more credible as a source.
Hmm.
Sean's more than likely on drugs and doesn't remember what he said, whereas Brett's more likely to have committed that to memory to hold against him forever.
Yeah.
or
written it down in general. So yeah, I kind of accept Brett's version of events. Brett then leaves the ring without shaking Sean's hand, which was apparently subtly part of the build for a rematch, but caused some backstage to think that there was legitimate heat between the two of them.
Hmm.
The crowd shows Blade Hart singing Shawn Michaels' theme. Brett leaves the ring, as Sean kneels staring at the belt. Brett looks pissed. Genuinely upset.
Yeah.
Sean celebrates with Pyro as Vince talks about the boyhood dream finally coming true. And this perhaps is, Vince's one great line on commentary that he ever gets is the boyhood dream of Shawn Michaels has come true.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Sean celebrates briefly with Blade Hart and kisses Helen Hart and a guy wearing a Smash by the Offspring t-shirt. Mm-hmm. Great album.
Great album.
Yeah, really good.
Well done, whoever wore that to WrestleMania 12. Would this match be better with Jim Ross on commentary?
Probably.
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, what's your thoughts on how they booked the match? Go into a draw.
So apparently the original plan was for it to be 2-2. Then it got changed to 1-1. Then it was changed to 0-0. I understand why they've done it in that if Sean is going to become the new champion, you don't necessarily want to show him being pinned at all before he wins the belt, because he would then kind of look weak before he does it. Had it been in front of a more appreciative crowd, maybe they'd have bought into the match more than the California crowd, which just wants to see a pin.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that, this crowd would have been happy with it being about 15 all.
Yeah. But yeah, you'd have come out with a champion that's already been pinned 15 times by a challenger, you know. So yeah, I've got no problem with it being 0-0. And like I say, pleasantly surprised by a reviewing of it based good. Upon kind of an expectation that I'd set back up for myself on it.
Although overall, I'd say I enjoyed the match. The one bit that I thought was quite weak was the section where it ended before the kind of end to restart of the match.
Right.
I didn't like how that was done. I thought that was a bit...
I think it's kind of confusing in that, you know, no mention was kind of made of overtime.
Yeah.
You know, Roddy Piper said there had to be a winner.
Yeah.
But nothing was said about what would happen if it went to 60 minutes.
Yeah. Well, I think it was, you know, it was really hot, though. That last kind of couple of minutes was quite hot in the match. But then... as Brett just walks off and there's this confusion, I think it would have looked better if both people had been in the ring.
Going, what happens
yeah,
now?
Yeah, what happens next? If yeah. it's all perplexed and then it resolves. Because it kind of looked for a while, although I obviously knew it didn't happen, that Brett was just going to walk off and that was going to be it and it was going to
that's
be
the end of the pay-per-view.
A BS finish. And for me, I think that spoilt it a bit.
I mean, the thing is, you would expect that sort of fine print to be detailed prior to the match in that it kind of makes a mockery of Brett's claim that, you know, I don't have to beat Sean.
Yeah.
He does have to beat Sean.
Yeah.
He has to win. Mm. You know, if not in the 60 minutes, then he has to win in overtime. So they could have made that part of the match clearer.
Yeah.
Which perhaps would have helped the audience at home, if not the crowd in the arena.
Yeah.
Remember Bill Watts' stint as Booker in the autumn of 1995?
Yeah. Fondly, yes.
So, reported by the Wrestling Observer at the time and repeated by Brett in his book, apparently the reason Watts actually quit was the clash between he and Vince over who should be champion. Vince wanted the belt on Sean, but Watts felt that Brett was more credible as a champion and that business was starting to turn around with Brett on top, so that he should stay as the champion. I'll reference Sean's book here as well, which I mentioned to you before we recorded, where he describes Brett as not a great wrestler and unable to change up his routine. He says Brett was very, very good, but not great, and didn't do a lot of exciting stuff. What a load of bollocks. Fuck you, Shawn Michaels. Yes, you're an exciting wrestler, but so is Brett, and we've seen numerous instances of him working different styles of match against different people.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Where he's got that comment from is just, you know, that was at the time when they weren't on good terms, I guess, so he's just decided to put that little dig in. Who do you think you are?
Unfortunately for you, Stuart, I'm Shawn Michaels.
On the Greatest Rivalries DVD set, Brett and Shawn seem insistent that the two were still relatively amicable at the time, with Brett's only potential problem being with Shawn that he seemingly planned to only defend against his buddies once he's captured the title. So prior to WrestleMania, he's telling people, oh, I'm going to defend against Diesel, then I'm going to defend against Razor, then I'm going to defend against The Kid, then I'm going to defend against Triple H. And Brett's sort of like, hang on, I can see what's going on here. Like, you've got no plans to defend against a Vader or an Austin or a Bulldog or anyone like that.
Or him.
Or me.
Or him, yeah. Brett will now be gone for a number of months from television. After competing on the post-Mania foreign tours, he'll be pursuing some acting opportunities and taking a well-deserved break. Rumours around WrestleMania time were that Brett would be back by SummerSlam to face Shawn in a rematch for the title, supposedly a ladder match.
Hmm.
So, WrestleMania 12, thoughts?
I enjoyed it.
Yeah, pretty good.
Overall, pretty enjoyable card.
It wasn't WrestleMania 10.
No. I would argue this is probably stronger as a whole show, but WrestleMania 10 has higher high points.
Yeah. Okay.
So Shawn, Razor and Bret Owen are obviously massive high points, but then you've got stuff like Adam Bomb Earthquake and things like that, and Yoko Lex Luger, which are thoroughly shit.
Because there's nothing shit on this show, is there? I mean, some people might say that the Warrior thing was, but oh, I don't.
As a Warrior fan, you were happy with that.
Exactly, yeah.
You didn't really like Savio Austin, but I thought it was
like
all right.
But it wasn't a shit match.
No celebrities whatsoever.
Mm.
Coming a year on from Celebrity Mania 11, this was quite different. You know, it's solely focused on the people that work for the company, which I thought was a really interesting change of philosophy.
Mm. Well, they spent the extra money on.
I think the main event is great, and it's definitely something different and definitely kind of the right way to present those two as your two top athletes.
Yeah, I'd say that don't watch it if you want to go in and watch a really excited Shawn Michaels high-flying match. But if you know a bit of the context around it and you know what it's about, then yeah, it's definitely worth a look.
I think it definitely positions your product in a very certain way, which almost directly contradicts some of the other stuff that they've had on the show.
Yeah, Goldust Piper is definitely different.
Yeah.
And Undertaker Diesel for a big man match is very good.
Mm.
Yeah.
I'd definitely say check out this show. It's not the worst
six-man tag match is not great, but it's not offensive. There's plenty of interesting mildly comic stuff going on in it. So I think really
there's enough to like on WrestleMania
definitely,
12.
Definitely,
it's definitely an improvement from WrestleMania 11.
Yes, mm-hmm.
Match of the night and MVP.
Well, for me, it's got to be the Iron Man match and Shawn. And partly for the fact that I think it's really brave to do something like an Iron Man match, because you've got to know that if you get the pacing wrong, if you get the psychology wrong, nobody's
going to be
like
a stinker.
I mean, they must be aware that doing an hour-long match is going to polarise people, and some people aren't going to have the, you know,
the attention span.
Well, not just the attention span, but aren't just going to like that style of how you're going to have to pace things. So I think it's quite brave in that it puts a lot of pressure on, you know, two people, because you've not got all these run-ins booked in.
Yeah, like
you're not
like
using a lot of outside distractions.
Like
to
the,
keep
the Triple H Rock Iron Man match, which yeah. people really like, but the amount of distractions in that is phenomenal.
Mm. It for me is just interesting how brave it was to do that, and how much pressure it puts on too many people, and the fact that they did a pretty commendable job, and athletically they could keep going that long, even with rust holes and stuff. I think it's still
the cardio shape you must have to be in to do an hour, just the two of you.
Even just to pick somebody up for a few seconds takes a lot of effort, so to do a whole hour's cardio stuff is amazing.
And your choice of Shawn as the MVP,
I think you got to give it to him, because it is his night. And for me, one of the things that stood out is the fact that, you know, he was doing some of the groundwork with Brett. That was quite interesting.
Adam?
Yeah, match of the night has to be the main event, I think. But I'd also be tempted to think about the Taker Diesel match.
Yeah,
I think
absolutely.
There's one thing that you can say about this match is it's paced right, is that your bigger, better matches that have more expectation, are generally better worked, are towards the end of the pay-per-view, rather than what we've seen all too often is where you have something really good about your second match in, and then your main event's a big part of
that.
Eight
minutes.
Yeah, so really good stuff, but yeah, the Iron Man match has to take it. For my MVP, I really wanted to say the Timekeeper in the main event. I mean, fucking hell. And I'm going to say, and this is from a completely selfish point of view,
the Warrior.
Warrior. Yeah. Mm. Because there's nothing else that we've watched during this that have really taken me back to being like a little kid.
Okay.
And seeing the Warrior come out was really cool. I think anything else we see him in is not going to have that effect, but for just this this one bit, I thought it was great.
I'm going to be very interested to see what you think of next month.
Mm. Yeah. Well, the other thing that I'll say is Mrs. Scrivens actually gave her MVP as Randy Orton.
Match of the night, Iron Man, although certainly a commendable effort to the Taker Diesel match. And MVP, I'm going to give to Brett, just because, well, I'd already had him written down and Paul went with Shawn, so. it took two men to put that together, and Shawn's assertions of him not being a great wrestler can fuck right off. to be perfectly honest. Mullet of the night.
It's already been mentioned, it's a double win from my corner for the Ultimate Warrior and his ultimate mullet.
What is it about Warrior's mullet that makes it so special?
I think it was paving ways in the early 90s when, you know, mullets were big, actually. Mullets were really
that's
big.
That's the whole point of them, Adam.
Yeah, but but no, we would. That's not always the case. And we're not going to get into that now. But
that's a whole bonus episode waiting to happen.
But at this sort of, like, 1990 sort of time, everyone seemed to have a mullet in wrestling. But,
yeah.
But Warrior had something.
Except King Kong Bundy.
Yeah, so people that are bald didn't. But he was creating something massive, and it was commendable even amongst the elite of mullets at that time. So I think that's probably what it is. You know, you think mulleted wrestler, most people will kind of, if they were watching wrestling at that time, will think Ultimate Warrior. And when he's standing out from a crowd like that, I think that tells you what it is about his haircut.
And on that bombshell, you can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/NewGenerationProjectPodcast. We are also on Twitter
at the completely unfathomable
New Gen Podcast. You can, as ever, rate, review and subscribe for all of our episodes as soon as they are available in iTunes.
Oh, hang on. Do you see that some guy put a Chris Morris reference in?
I did see some guy put a Chris Morris reference.
So we'd better say that. Thank you.
If iTunes isn't your thing, you can also check out new episodes on SoundCloud at soundcloud.com/newgenpodcast, on Stitcher Radio or on piledriverwrestling.net. Or if you've just found us and want to catch up, our back catalogue is going up one by one by one on botchamania.com, and adding to our list of affiliates, our back catalogue is also going up on insidetheropes.com, and you'll be able to check out some of their audio over on our SoundCloud page, including their review of WWE Fastlane. Calling Spots issue 13 is available now for just $1.99 at callingspots.com. Tell them, Paul.
Buy it.
yeah, I wrote about Kevin Owens in it, and he's particularly relevant right now. So give it a read if you're new to him or just want a sort of concise summary of how he got to where he is. Episode 33 will be In Your House, Good Friends, Better Enemies.
Ooh, it's got a name.
Yeah, they don't have numbers anymore. They have names. Good Friends, Better Enemies.
Relevant now. They don't have numbers. They have play buttons.
It's In Your House, multiplication sign. My name is Stuart Brooks. I shall say goodbye.
I'm Adam White's goodbye.
I'm the just at CS Paul Scrivens goodbye.
Dropping the axiom.
Oh, better now. It's not really caught on, has it?
Dark as shame, darling, dark as shame. Thank you for all the joy and pain. Picture show, second balcony, was the place we'd meet. Second seat, gold Dutch treat, you were sweet. Dark as shame, darling. Save those lies, darling, don't explain. I recall Central Park in fall, how you tore your dress, what a mess. I confess, that's not all. Dark as shame.
You're still here. It's over. Go home. Go.